Okay, if we could get started. We'd like to welcome you out tonight to the RAC meeting. My name is Dave Black. I'm the chairman of the RAC. I'm from St. George. Represent the public at large. Before we introduce the rest of the RAC to you, I'd like to recognize the chairman of the Wildlife Board, Jake Albrecht, who's here with us. Wave your hand, Jake. We appreciate you coming down and supporting us. We also understand that Steve Dalton will be here tonight, who's also a member of the Wildlife Board. I don't see him here yet, but we appreciate their support. With that, let's start down here on the end with Lane, and we'll let the RAC introduce themselves.
Lane Torgerson from Ridgefield. I'm a sportsman's representative.
Mike Staley from Delta. I'm at large.
Dale Bagley from Marysville, elected official.
Mac Morrell Bicknell for agriculture.
I'm Claire Woodbury from Herrick, and I represent the public at large.
Kevin Dunnell from here in Cedar City. I'm the regional supervisor for the Division of Wildlife, and I just act as executive secretary on this board.
Sam Carpenter from Kanab. I represent sportsmen.
Cordell Pearson from Circleville. I represent at large.
Sean Kelly from Fillmore. Representing the Forest Service.
Rusty Aiken from Cedar City, agriculture.
Mike Worthen, Cedar City, public at large.
Brian Johnson, Cedar City, Enoch, actually, and non-consumptive.
Thank you. Our first action item tonight is to review the minutes and accept the agenda. Do we have a motion from the RAC to accept the minutes and the agenda? Okay. We have a motion by Mike and a second by Rusty. All in favor? That's unanimous. Okay. Item number three will be an informational update. I had the opportunity to attend the Wildlife Board meeting this last week, and I wanted to review their motions and what they did with our recommendations as they went to the Wildlife Board. If you recall, last time we talked about the fishing guidebook, we had made a motion to allow a three-day possession limit and to remove the preserved fish from the total possession limit. There was quite a bit of discussion. There was some, and they considered our motion, and what they've decided to do is that they will put on the questionnaire this coming year a question regarding the three-day possession limit, and also addressing the preserved fish. And so it's probably going to be another year before they take action on that, but there will be a questionnaire that goes out to address that with the public. We had also made a motion that on the next survey that goes out, they add a question regarding the taking of catch and kill species by spear fishermen, and they approve that motion, so that will be on the questionnaire. Also, as a Southern RAC, we included a motion that with the next survey there be a question regarding the instating of the 8-fish limit statewide, and that was approved unanimous as far as it will be on the questionnaire for next year. So all three of those, four of those items will be on the questionnaire, and then we'll be able to, they'll come before the RAC again next year. And they, then with that, we made a motion to accept the remainder of the fish guide and the rule as presented, and that was also approved by the Wildlife Board. Now, one other item that came up was we had a motion to create an action item for the board to address the theft of trail cameras to include wildlife-related penalties. And what they are going to do that is they're going to turn that over to the law enforcement for research, and hopefully then we will get a presentation or a response back on that, but there was no action taken with that item. We'll turn the time over to Kevin for an update now.
Thanks, Dave. One other thing before I move on to a regional update in relation to the Wildlife Board that's in particular interest to this RAC. You remember, probably about a year ago at this time, the members of this RAC asked us to look into seeing if we can get Duck Creek and the little lakes that are up around Duck Creek open to winter fishing. And that was put on the action log for the board. We reported back to the board on that at this last board meeting. We do have a solution to that. We've talked with Kane County and the Kane County Sheriff along with UDOT. What they're going to do is UDOT's going to post some signs along the highway there, making it clear that you can't park along the highway, because the only reason it was ever closed, I guess I should start there, was because of safety concerns and people parking along the road there in the winter and the issues that they had with snow plows and other things. So they're going to post some signs making it clear that you can't park along the highway. They are going to push a couple of small parking lots, and then Kane County and the Kane County Sheriff will patrol that a little bit to make sure that people aren't parking along the road. Unfortunately, it'll still be a year from now before that's actually opened in the guidebook, but I anticipate that we'll be able to do that so that in the 2015 fishing season we'll be able to have Duck Creek and those the other little lakes, I forget the name of the other one up there, open to fishing during the winter because we've been able to resolve the issue with parking. As far as a regional update, there's a lot going on. I'm going to take a minute and brag about my employees a little bit as well. First thing I've told you about Minersville and the repairs there on the dam over the last several months. Those were completed probably today. You know what, the division put $30,000 into using divers to repair that dam rather than drain the reservoir completely so that we could preserve the fishery. That was a big win. It would have taken us several years to rebuild that fishery if we would have had to drain it. So the sportsmen stepped up and the division dug deep and found some money and we were able to get that done. And the ram on the control structure for that dam was went in yesterday and today with divers doing all the work. The other thing out of our aquatics program is just keep your eyes open. The Fish Lake and Boulder Mountain management plan meetings will be beginning shortly, and there'll be some notices going out there. So if you have an interest in how we manage the fisheries on Boulder Mountain and Fish Lake, you'll want to get involved with that. Our wildlife section has been really busy over the last month or so. First off, I think we had a very successful deer hunt this year compared to seasons past. We had a lot of young 3 and 4 point bucks and body condition on the deer that were coming through our check stations this year was really good. All the rain that we had last summer has really allowed those deer to go into winter in really good shape, and so they should do just fine this winter. You've probably seen the coverage of our sheep transplants. We moved 49 sheep from Nevada into some canyons just off of Lake Powell in the Escalante unit. That was a very complicated undertaking. Logistically, it included, helicopters on both ends and boats and everything else. We actually had to fly the sheep in to get them into the area because it's very remote. You know, just kind of a quick story with that. The last two sheep that when they opened the boxes to release them, instead of running up the canyon like the other 47 had done before them, they decided to turn around and run backwards, and they actually jumped into Lake Powell. And our guys that were there had been flown in, so they didn't have a boat or any way to to go help them. So they actually found a guy that was out there fishing, I assume, and essentially commandeered his boat and went and rescued. They were able to pull one of the sheep that was swimming out of the water, get it in the boat, and take it back over to the area. The other sheep made it across and pulled itself out. But, you know, our guys will go a long ways, especially when it comes to sheep, when they put because of the amount of time and effort they put into it. The other thing related to bighorn sheep, our flights have begun in doing our surveys and classifying sheep. They've been flying the Zion unit the last couple of days. There's good and bad news there. The good news is there's a lot of sheep in the Zion unit. The bad news is there's a lot of sheep in the Zion unit. And when sheep densities get high, we get very concerned because sheep are prone to start wandering at that point, which puts it at high risk to come in contact with domestic sheep, which is in some cases is a very bad thing for wild sheep, because they bring back disease. The primary issue is actually in Zion National Park. We're hoping, we're meeting to convince the park to let us capture some sheep out of the park this year. We'll be meeting with them the end of this month, but it's far from a done deal at this point, but we'll continue to work hard on that. Deer classifications will be starting here immediately. And go over the next 5 to 6 weeks. Our youth pheasant hunt that happened this last weekend out at the Pavant WMA was a really well done event. We appreciate the sportsmen, especially Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, for partnering with us there and allowing us to release a bunch of pheasants and give 100 kids a really neat experience and hopefully develop a lifelong passion for hunting. Also with pheasants, if you haven't seen the news, we are releasing over 11,000 pheasants throughout the state this year. The division's done. They'll come in waves. The first two waves are done. The last one will be this Friday at several of our WMAs, and you can go on the website and find out where those are. They'll be birds released Friday night, and we're hoping that people going to take advantage of those over the weekend. And actually, it's been the reports I've been given, the hunting on those WMAs where the birds have been released has remained good throughout the week after those releases. So especially if you have any young ones around your house or grandkids, a good opportunity to get them excited about hunting. We will be doing some additional fawn collaring on the Monroe and the Pine Valley studies coming up in December. So if especially the RAC members or really anybody else that's interested in getting involved with that, let us know. We can provide some opportunities to get some hands-on experience. And then in January, it'll continue with deer transplants and capturing sheep in the Zion unit, moving sheep onto the Oak Creek unit, assuming that things go as they have in the last two racks and the Wildlife Board coming up with that item that we'll talk about tonight. And then you know, our habitat section this is the time of year where they're extremely busy putting seed on the ground and doing all the projects, and then they start praying for snow so that next spring everything greens up well. The government shutdown put a lot of pressure on our habitat folks because the partners in the BLM and the Forest Service weren't available right at the time when we were trucking seed all over the state and doing all sorts of things. So our habitat section has had has been burning the candle at both ends a little bit, but they've managed to keep their heads above water. And then lastly, our law enforcement guys have, I'll read it the way Scott put it here, that they're licking their wounds after an insane September and October. We're short several conservation officers in the region right now, and so the other guys have had to fill in. They've done yeoman's work in making sure that everything's getting covered, but they've put in a lot of long hours and a lot of long days, and so we're hoping that they can get a little bit of a respite now. With that, I think I'll send it back to you, Dave.
Thank you, Kevin. As you look at the agenda, we see we have quite a few items on the agenda this evening. So just before we get started, I just want to run through the meeting order. First, on each action item will have a presentation, and then there will be an opportunity for questions from the RAC and then questions from the public. And just remember at this time that these are just questions. And if you have comments, then you'll have an opportunity to comment. But in order to do so, you need to get a yellow card, fill that out, give it to one of the DWR representatives. They'll bring that up to us. And then we'll move into the comments section, where there'll be comments from the RAC and also comments from the public. And so with that, we'll move into our first action item, which is number five, and Bucks Bowls, and that's with Justin.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Justin Shannon. Tonight I'm going to present the Bucks Bowls and once-in-a-lifetime season dates, hunt structures, and rule changes. So to begin, we'll talk about the 2014 deer hunt recommendations. So for next fall, essentially what we've done for all three of these hunts is just simply move them up one day. The archery hunt will start August 16th and go through September 12th. Muzzleloader will be September 24th through October 2nd. And then the any weapon will still start in that third weekend in October and go from October 18th to the 26th. For general season elk hunt dates, the six hunts we have here, the archery spike dates will go from August 16th through September 5th, and then any bull will have the same start date, but it'll go all the way up until September 12th. Any weapon will still be that first Saturday in October, October 4th through the 16th. The muzzleloader hunt will be October 29th through November 6th. Youth any bull, September 13th through the 21st, and then the late youth any bull will be November 29th through January 15th. What I'd like to do now, format-wise, is talk about recommendations that affect the state as a whole and go through those. I think there's five or six, and then we'll break it down and go region by region with recommendations that are relevant just to them. So the first thing we'd like to do that has statewide implications is update Rule 657-5, and This is where any person 17 years of age or younger on July 31st would qualify as a youth. What we want to do is standardize this for the big game program, and then as we move forward with this, our intent down the road is to standardize it for upland game, waterfowl hunting, cougar bear, every hunt we have. So when you see the word youth with the Division of Wildlife, you know what it represents. Right now there's not alignment based on if you're a waterfowl hunter or upland game hunter, or even big game hunter. But for right now, we'd just like to update that for Rule 657-5. All right. We'd also recommend adding an addendum to the statewide deer plan that allows for mule deer transplants and also lists potential release sites. What we're recommending, what I've done is mapped it out on the right and then listed it in table form on the left. The units that we'd like to have these areas serve as release sites for mule deer would be the Box Elder, the 9 Mile, the San Juan Elk Ridge, Current Creek, West Desert West, Southwest Desert, Fillmore Oak Creek and Pavant, and then Mount Dutton. And just to clarify, this is where mule deer would be released to, not where we'd take them from. There's lots of places in the state that could serve as potential source herds. But what we're trying to do is lay the foundation to where if we have deer in hand, we have a place that we can put them and lay that groundwork down and be transparent about where we'd like to take these animals. One thing that these units have in common is they're away from the Wasatch Front, that they have adequate winter range that could hold these deer, and historically they held more deer. Okay, next I'd like to talk about an action item that we were given in May of this year. The Wildlife Board asked the Southern Region specifically to determine if the Monroe unit required a different hunt strategy. And so in October, the Southern Region, they met with sportsmen, I think it was in Richfield, if I remember right, and what came of that meeting is there were a lot of concerns over spike harvest. And so there were a lot of things discussed there at the meeting, and one that the group really liked, the sportsman group liked, was eliminating spike hunting for the entire unit. Another option would be eliminating spike hunting just for the any weapon portion of the hunt. So that way archery and muzzleloader hunters could still hunt spikes on the unit, but the any weapon portion where we have the most hunters and the most harvest would be done away with for the Monroe. And then, as with everything in wildlife, the status quo is always an option, leaving it as is. Last Thursday, I believe, on November 7th, the Southern Region, they reported their findings to the Wildlife Board. And now, as we go through the RAC and board process, our recommendation that the division is going forward, is that the division's proposing, is to recommend eliminate any weapon spike elk hunting on the Monroe until the next statewide elk plan is approved, which is about 2 years. It's kind of that middle ground of doing away with all of it or leaving it the same. It's doing away with the any weapon portion. And this gives us a couple of years to do quite a bit. It can help us evaluate how we want to manage elk on the Monroe. As you know, it's what we call in the wildlife profession a meta population of elk. We have elk going to and from the Monroe, yet the boundaries of it, we kind of focus on the one area. And so it gives us a chance to evaluate how we want to manage elk on the Monroe, the Fish Lake, the Dutton, the Boulder, places like that. Okay, another recommendation that has statewide implications is recommending allowing archery hunting of big game on select WMAs. And these are our waterfowl management areas. These include Bicknell Bottoms, Browns Park, Clear Lake, Desert Lake, Locomotive Springs, and Redmond. And the idea behind this is we could potentially harvest archery deer and pronghorn that are inhabiting these waterfowl management areas. And the waterfowl hunts don't start until October, and so there's no temporal overlap with that. And so it's a way to provide a little more big game hunting opportunity. Finally, we recommend altering Rule 657-5 to allow for the use of crossbows, draw locks, and magnifying scopes on muzzleloaders during the any weapon hunts only. We also recommend altering Rule 657-12 to align with the changes in 657-5. 657-5 is just the big game rule, and then 657-12 deals with special use with different types of permits, like muzzleloaders and archery equipment, different things like that, crossbows. Since we have that rule open, we'd like to do some basic house cleaning, housekeeping with it. We want to delete some examples are deleting the definition of highway. It's defined there, yet it's never used. We defined what resident is. It's redundant because it's already outlined in code. And we use terms like valid application, which we just don't use anymore. And so it's just cleaning it up and making it more simple. We also provide definitions and minimum requirements for crossbows and draw logs. Okay, now I'd like to go from the statewide perspective and just go region by region. So we'll start with the Southern Region. We're recommending modifying the Pine Valley Virgin River Bighorn Sheep boundary to be consistent with the deer, elk, and pronghorn unit boundaries. We have some bighorns that are going outside of that boundary, and we wanted to expand it and give hunters an opportunity to potentially harvest those animals. And it's simpler. If you look up the Pine Valley unit, you don't have several definitions. You'd have one for a variety of species. We recommend modifying the Panguitch Lake pronghorn boundary to account for an expanding pronghorn population. And then we recommend modifying the Mount Dutton / Ponsagat and the Parker Mountain pronghorn boundaries to avoid overharvest of the Johns Valley herd. Right now, the Johns Valley herd can be hunted if you draw the Parker Mountain permit, and so we'd like to redefine that boundary, pull that out of it, and include it with the Mount Dutton and Ponsagat pronghorn unit because there's a lot fewer tags and there'd be a lot less hunting pressure potentially on that Johns Valley population. For the Southeast Region, we recommend splitting the 9-mile Range Creek Bighorn Sheep Hunt into an early and a late hunt. Each hunt will be roughly 15 days in November. This unit has limited access in the most permits in the state. There's essentially one access point that you can really get to, and we have upwards to 20 permits for it, and so we just wanted to break it up so guys weren't shooting rams out from under each other. In the northern region, we recommend modifying the season dates on the Grouse Creek Limited Entry Elk Hunt to September 13th through the 21st, which are standard. But then we'd also want to include October 4th through the 28th. Also want to include an archery and a muzzleloader season to increase bull harvest on this portion of the unit. And then, for the northern region, we recommend combining units 2, 3, and 4, which is the Cache, Ogden, and Morgan Southridge for pronghorn. This unit, sometimes pronghorn will stay on private lands throughout the hunt, and so if we have that happen, it gives hunters a little bit of variety, areas that we know that there will be pronghorn on public land, so we didn't sell them a camping trip, essentially. So. And for the northeast region, we recommend expanding the boundary for the Uinta Basin Extended Archery Deer and Elk Hunt to target resident big game living in low elevation and agricultural lands. We recommend creating a new bison hunt on the Book Cliffs, and we recommend splitting the Book Cliffs Limited Entry Deer Hunt into a north and a south unit for the any weapon portion of the hunt. And this is to address discrepancies in buck-to-doe ratios. On the south end of that unit, you can get really high buck-to-doe ratios, and on the north, they could be really low. And so depending where you're at on the unit, you can make a case for cutting or increasing permits. And so we wanted to parse those out and manage those for the rifle hunt, essentially, to match permits to what the buck-to-doe ratio should be. For the central region, we recommend removing bull elk from the San Pete Valley Extended Archery Elk Hunt. We also recommend adding a Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheet Hunt for units 16A and 17A. This essentially encompasses Mountain Timpanogos, Rock Canyon, and Mount Nebo. And then finally, we recommend combining the Wasatch Mountains, the Box Elder Peak, the Lone Peak, and the Timpanogos units for mountain goat hunting. And this is because of declining counts that we've seen on Box Elder Peak and Lone Peak, and just thought it might make more sense to combine it. We got some interesting movements going on right now, and so we'd like to combine that for hunter satisfaction's sake. Some key dates to keep in mind and for your consideration tonight: the big game drawing for bucks, bulls, and once in a lifetime, and the new dedicated hunter applicants will be from January 30th through March 6th. The bonus point and preference point application period will also start January 30th, but it'll go through March 20th, and these results will be posted by May 30th. If you're a lifetime license hunter, you'll automatically be assigned the unit that you had the previous year. If you want to make changes to that, must be submitted by March 6th. And those that didn't hunt in 2013 and failed to choose a unit by the deadline, they can go and obtain leftover permits if they're available. This last slide I have deals with our hunters with disabilities on the general season units. I don't think I'll go over each one individually, but essentially what we've done is we've either chosen a 5-day window prior to or after the hunt, and if we have hunters with disabilities, they can apply for that and hunt those 5 extra days. So, and if there's specific questions, I can go into it further. And with that, that's all I have, so thank you.
Thank you, Justin. Do we have any questions from the RAC? Okay, hold on. Go ahead. Claire, go ahead.
My question is on the Monroe unit, when it says the region met with sportsmen in October. Who were the sportsmen that were chosen to be at that meeting? Was that SFW, or was it a particular club, or what was it? And how come nobody else knew anything about it?
SFW is certainly there. I didn't personally attend the meeting. Teresa, do you want to speak to that, who was invited and notice and different things?
Yeah, what we did is we contacted most of the members of the Monroe Elk Committee that have met in previous years, and those that attended, and including some sportsmen, that word got around among sportsmen that we're having the meeting. But we had RAC members, board members, SFW, Mueller Foundation, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Livestock Producer, the Monroe Landowner Association, Sevier County Commission, and probably a dozen or so or more concerned sportsmen there.
Did you get that question, an answer? Okay, thank you. Claire, go ahead.
Is there a problem with too many spikes being killed on that unit? Or have you done a study on that, or is this just a knee-jerk reaction to their wants?
It's an interesting question, because I think if you look at the Monroe and you solely focused on the Monroe, yeah, we're probably taking a disproportionate amount of spikes there. But if you look at the complex, the 10,000 elk that interchange between the four units, we're right in line with other parts of the states, other big populations like the Manti or other portions like that, percent-wise. And so I guess the way to answer that question is it's all how you want to look at it scale-wise. If you look just at the Monroe, yeah, there's a lot of spikes being killed. So that's probably the best way to answer that.
A follow-up question to that. Does that translate into fewer mature bulls on that unit, or is it taken into account that those other units or those other elk that migrate in take their place?
Yeah, potentially. And I guess that's why we want to be cautious with it. That's why we want to have a conservative recommendation right now to do away with any weapon portion until we can learn a little bit more about that unit. We do have some collar data that indicates that certainly elk move on to that unit. And we're having internal discussions about collaring elk on all those units to learn a little bit more about it. But it has the potential to do what you're saying, that you could potentially lose some older bulls if you looked at that unit. I think the complex as a whole, you're probably in pretty good shape. But on that unit, yeah, you would lose quality taking that many spikes.
Shouldn't we have some data before we make this drastic move, where all those hunters would have to go to units surrounding and put extra pressure on the Pavant, the Beaver, the Plateau?
The data that we do have shows that we're killing 165 spikes off of a unit that has 1,400 wintering elk. And so that's the data that we're citing that causes us some concern. Migrational data on elk is difficult, it's expensive, things like that. So certainly we'd love an opportunity to get more, but this is, again, a middle-of-the-road recommendation to try to be receptive to what the public's asking and seeing and certain things like that, and still maintain opportunity for spike hunters.
So you say 165 spikes are being killed on that Monroe unit? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So we have the harvest data, but we don't have the whole picture yet.
Vance, why don't you come up and address the data on the Monroe a little bit, in a little more detail.
Sure. I think, let me just show you a few graphs that might help out. Let's see, how do I get to, here we go. This slide just shows the elk. We've had an elk hunt since 2009 on Monroe, so 4 years. That fifth graph there, the columns that you see, is the average. And so starting in 2009, first elk hunt, so we're averaging 137 spikes, and of course that's 2012 was the highest number of harvest that we've had. There's just an example of how many hunters are hunting those units. The most important number being the any weapon type hunt. So, in 2012, we had 755 any weapon spike hunters on the unit. And then if we want to look at the average number of, say, the any weapon hunt, 681. And then if you continue down that column, you see the archery hunt numbers and the muzzleloader hunt numbers on average. So we're averaging just under 1,000 total hunters if you combine all the units. As you can see, a pretty good success rate on the rifle spike hunt. And on the rifle hunt, we did harvest 124 spikes just on the rifle hunt. Here we, this just shows the, our wintering population. And as you can see, Monroe, the top unit, our winter population estimate was 1,400 animals. We flew that unit last year. In fact, all these units that you see listed below, we flew. So if you look at the Monroe and the Dutton next to each other, the Dutton has a larger wintering population. And of course, that includes quite a few Monroe elk, but we only harvested 70 spikes on that unit versus 165 on the Monroe. So, as you can see, there's quite a few. We just harvest a higher proportion of spikes, probably between 60 and 80% of the spikes are harvested annually on Monroe, compared with only 35-40% on the adjoining units. And most of that's due to access, probably.
What number are you looking at to survive a post hunt survival rate on the spikes to keep the
good
big
question.
Wolves in the numbers we want?
Yeah, good question. What you do is you look at how many spikes or how many calves are born, in the population every year, and then you take divide that in half. I say calves or spikes. You look at the number of calves that are produced every year with the population that you have. Divide that in half, and you have the yearling bulls. You carry that over to next year. You subtract a percentage for, natural mortality and things like that. So it tells you about how many spikes are available that should be available on that unit. And then you look at the harvest numbers, and you get an approximate percent of the harvest.
The question I was asking, what is the goal that you would like to see on the survival rate on the spikes after the hunt?
I don't know if we that's really not part of the plan as far as that goes, but what we do want to do is have adequate survival to produce an adequate number of large bulls that are recruited in the population for any bull hunters. And so,
right, and that was my question. How many do we need to keep the big bulls numbers up on the Monroe?
Yeah, and so.
And that's kind of nebulous?
Yeah, a little bit nebulous. What we do know is that we're harvesting more, a higher percentage on Monroe, fewer on the adjoining units.
Vance, I think you could answer that if you walk through your two surveys, the 2009 and 2012 or whatever they are.
Right here. Okay, good. So if we look at 2009, the aerial survey that we completed, the 2009 survey was pre-spike hunt, so before we had that first spike hunt. There you see the actual count and the count of antlerless. And the most important thing to look at here is not necessarily the number of spikes that we counted or big bulls that we counted, but really the ratio per 100 antlerless animals. And that gives us, because sightability issues come into play when you're counting big bulls in the air, they're just very hard to count, or bulls in general. And so we look at the ratio of bull to cow. So if we look at the yearling bull surveys, in 2009, we had 11 basically spike bulls per 100 antlerless. And then in our survey this last winter, we only had 3.4, which shows that we harvested a pretty large percentage of our spikes. And we can carry that on down. We look at the branch bull, which are our basically our 2.5-year-old bulls. We went from 4.2 per 100 antlerless to 2.1, so roughly about half there. And then if we look at our mature bull, we went from 15.6 per 100 antlerless down to about 9.2. So we have, I think we have affected the bull segment of that population, not in an emergency, way, but it is significant.
Yeah, if I remember right, part of the reason we went statewide, or mostly statewide on the spike hunt, was to decrease the number of bulls.
Correct.
To get more in line with, a natural population, I guess you'd say. And I just wonder maybe that's what that graph is showing.
Yeah, yeah. And if I could just show you one other thing that might... I'm missing one graph on here. I was just going to show you, historically, Monroe has been... managed as a limited entry only unit until 2009. So we had a lot of bulls, and then in the early 2000s, we lowered that age objective down to 5 and 6. So we really raised our any bull permits significantly, up over 100 permits for several years. And then we raised our objective back up to 7.5 to 8-year-old bulls just a couple of years ago. And in response to that, we've cut our big bull tags significantly in anticipation of of the effects of the spike bull hunt, and also be in reflecting the high bull harvest from several years previous to that. So you will see a big hump in the early 2000s with permit numbers.
Thank you. Yep.
Perhaps Vance. Run away.
Well, we still have some more questions.
Would you say that the effects of that, the lack of, or the less number of mature bulls, would be more of an effect of the increased tags from 07, 08, and 09 than the spike hunt?
You know, that's a good question. Our spike hunt, again, started in 2009, so those bulls would be approximately 5.5 years old this year. And so really, if you're looking at the really large bull population, you know, the 6-plus-year-old bulls, that effect's not really going to be seen too much until for the next year or two. So probably the biggest thing that have affected the number of big bulls available to hunters in the past several years was because of those high permit numbers in that time period.
Okay, and then one more question. We're managing Dutton, I believe, to 5.5 to 6.5 year age class. Same with Fish Lake. All those units are kind of intertwined. You've had dramatic increases on both those units. Do you think that's having an effect on the number of bulls? I mean, the spike hunt's getting a bad rap for a combination of several things.
I guess I don't quite understand the question, but you're right. The wintering herd on the Dutton is quite high, but I think having high elk numbers on adjoining units because of the interaction, the movement of the elk between units, I don't think that would hurt the bulls on Monroe.
Well, you've increased the permits on those other units.
I got you.
At the same time, you basically started the spike hunt. Just because of the age classifications have changed.
Yeah, okay.
Dutton and Fish Lake, they've increased significantly in the last 4 years, 5 years, which is the same time frame as the spikes. So.
Yeah, I understand that question. You know, again, like we've talked about, there's a lot of movement of elk in between those. And what we do on one unit definitely can affect, you know, what happens on another unit. But to actually be able to quantify that and say this has affected that, I really can't speak to that.
Okay, go ahead.
On the spike bull on the Monroe, you made a statement that the reason they're taking more spikes is because of the access. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's just a lot of roads on Monroe. There's not a lot of private ground refuge areas, and it's a great place for hunters to go. And so it's just popular. It gets a lot of pressure, and you harvest more yearlings there.
A lot of roads for access, but the other units, the Dutton, Fish Lake, and Boulder, is a little harder to hunt. So I don't know why that you would want to, since all those four units are kind of combined anyway with elk, why would you want to take the spike off the Monroe hunting spikes? Maybe, look, you ought to leave the number of permits or something there on Monroe and not just take everything out.
Yeah, you know, I think that's kind of what we're looking at, a compromise by keeping the muzzleloader hunt available there and the archery hunt available there for spikes, which would probably result in, you know, 40 to 50 spikes being harvested on Monroe, kind of a halfway in between recommendation.
Sam, go ahead.
Yeah, Vance, I've hunted spikes for many, many years, and I don't believe I've ever had anybody call or ask if I killed a spike. Where do you get these numbers? 165 elk on the Monroe. Have they started doing surveys, or do we just kind of, where does that come from?
That's our most important tool, is our harvest surveys. And they call a certain percentage of the hunters annually and ask them where they hunted, where they harvested, and that is where we generate these harvests.
So statistics. You have a formula from that you derive from the information you get to come up with 165, or did you talk to 165 people that actually killed a spike on the Monroe?
Yeah, we have. I believe in Salt Lake we have those numbers on how many we actually talked to generate this data. What that percentage is, I don't know.
It's about 25% on each unit, and so we're talking to one in four hunters. And so then that, you know, it's projected out. So probably 41 guys said, yeah, I killed a spike on the Monroe, and a lot of that's projected at that point. So. Yeah.
Brian, do you have a question?
Are you sure?
Yes. We'll be here a while.
We're gonna be here a while. Okay, I don't even know where to start with this. But we have a unit called the Monroe, and it's hooked up with three other units that are really hard to hunt. And the Monroe is the easiest one to hunt, and the Monroe has the highest age objective. Just want to make sure I'm catching that right.
You're right.
Okay,
it's
so
seven and a half to 8-year-old boy.
We've got the highest age objective. I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page here. On the easiest unit to hunt, if that's what we're doing, that's what we're doing. That's part of the elk plan. This spike hunt's part of the elk plan. I'm just wondering why we're mixing the bag up so much. And it sounds like it's 20 guys from Monroe that got mad. Am I wrong? Because there's 1,000 guys that hunt, and we had 20 guys on a committee. So you're the guy that was in charge of the meeting. What do we got?
Yeah, so, no, it's been a concern actually from day one. That was a big question, I think, that the Wildlife Board considered in the RAC back in 2009 or 2008 when they made those recommendations. We did anticipate a higher rate of harvest on these spikes. And it's actually been a common topic the last several years, and when we started seeing the total number of spikes and the total number of hunters that are hunting the Monroe unit. And so it's definitely not just those people that were at that meeting. Now, that's not to say that there isn't people that like the spike hunt, because there is. Exactly, and so those that came to the meeting and the Swarsom's groups that were there, that was the consensus, the direction that they wanted to go. So our recommendation reflected that.
Brian, let me respond to that a little bit. The spike hunt in general has been a really great tool for us. And, you know, Claire mentioned earlier that it's, you know, on some of the units like the San Juan, where a while ago we had a 1-to-1 bull to cow ratio, we are trying to get a more healthy situation with our elk populations. That's never been the case on the Monroe in terms of having as many bulls as we do cows. When you look at that slide, the one that puts this in perspective to me is you look at the Monroe with a population estimate of 1,400, and we killed 165 spikes. And then you look at the Fish Lake with 5,100, and we killed fewer spikes. The Monroe, so it's a combination of there was a concern that was raised, but then also we have data that supports the concern. And so that's why we made the recommendation.
I'm confused why we got the highest class.
Well, that's an issue that's going to have to be dealt with, or will certainly be discussed the next time the elk plan is done. And that's why we made this as a 2-year recommendation, because in that 2-year period the elk plan will be revisited. And I don't know where it's going to end up at that point.
Mike, did you have a question?
Brian hit on what I was going to ask one of them, but the other part, I guess, is a bigger picture part that I'm a little concerned with. We've got some of these bigger class bull units, such as the West Desert and Panguitch Lake, where we've got some good bulls coming out of there. And now, 4 years down the road, we're seeing in this unit that the spike hunt is impacting that bull unit, or them bull animals. Are we monitoring those other units to see what impact they're having, or are we going to go down the road in another year and say, oh, we don't have the production of them or the survivability of those spikes, so we're going to have to shut this down for 2 years?
Yeah, certainly that's a concern we have with doing this, because then with a recommendation going forward like this, it has the potential to open up that door to where guys can say, well, in my backyard, I don't like the quality or the size or the number of bulls. Let's do away with the spike hunt. For me, probably the best way to answer that is internally we really struggled with this recommendation. And what you'll find is no recommendation is perfect. It's just not the case. And with this, there's trade-offs. And the trade-off is, with doing away with this, you're right, there's going to be several hundred any weapon hunters that won't be able to hunt or potentially harvest on the any weapon portion of that hunt. That's one of the things that the recommendation has on you know, if the recommendation is a pendulum and you want to look at that as a loss of opportunity, that there's no denying that. That's what the data suggests. And so you're right. On the flip side, though, what we're trying to do is have a unit that is 7.5 to 8 year old bulls. And so the way we've got to do that is to preserve some bulls. And I know you could say, well, couldn't you just cut the tags on the back end? And we could. We could have a unit with 15, 20 tags, and that would be it. So we're earnestly trying to seek a balance between the opportunity of allowing spike hunters, and that's why we kept the archery and the muzzleloader, with trying to manage to a quality unit. And so that's where we're at with it. And that, your concerns are valid.
Down here, Mac.
Justin or Vance, I'm just kind of curious, given that we've been harvesting spikes on Monroe since 2009, mm-hmm. and we still haven't really, it's not enough time to figure out what effect that's having on the older right. bulls. Is 2 years going to be enough to see what effect this has on?
Yeah, probably not. Not to look at the spike harvest. I mean, we will have a couple more years worth of data. Right now, bulls that would have been killed as spikes in 2009 are 4.5 to 5.5. So that would put it to 6.5, 7.5. So yeah, it'd give us a little bit. But I think what the 2 years allows us to do as an agency and working with the public is to say, should this unit be managed at a broader scale? Because right now it's a section of a migratory herd. The other thing we can look at is age objectives. Is there, if we really have that big of a lack of alignment between having a unit that everybody can go to and there's a lot of access and we can kill 165 spikes on it, should units like that be managed for 7.5 to 8 year old? Yeah, I think those are really valid questions. And then if we are able to put a study together and look at some of the collaring data, at least we can be able to say, hey, here's what the movement patterns are. And that's going to take some time to put together. And I don't know if in 1 or 2 years we'll have all that, but we could get some preliminary data. So that's what we're really trying to gain out of this recommendation being 2 years before the next statewide plan. But as far as the spike hunting that we've had over the last 4 or 5 years, those data aren't reflected really because we've been managing for a higher age bull than that. So.
Now we had some questions at this end, Mike.
What would be the effect of leaving status, or having it status quo for 2 years and then address it then?
It's certainly an option. And it, you know, if the RAC wants to vote that way, and after hearing public comment and hearing our recommendation, that's what the public process is all about. All the agency was trying to do was define that middle ground. There's some serious concerns about lack of quality. Our own data suggests we're taking a disproportionate amount of spikes on the unit. But we are sensitive to losing all that spike harvest as well. So the effects would be in 2 years, we can convene, well, actually about a year and a half from now, we can convene an elk committee and talk about this dynamic down here. In the meantime, we'll probably continue to kill a disproportionate amount of spikes on the Monroe.
Yeah, but don't some of these other spikes migrate there back and
Certainly.
Forth?
Yeah, and that's what that was my point earlier, is if you look at the entire complex, we may be in good shape. We're yeah. probably similar to other units. If you only focus the data on the Monroe, it doesn't look promising.
Mike?
I had a question. Wasn't Monroe one of the few units that was under objective on population? I remember talking about this a year or two ago, and that's why we started discussing eliminating the spike bull hunt and maybe some cow hunts, because it is below objective, right, population?
In the winter count, yeah. I think in the summer it's going to hold more than 1,400 elk, okay. and those elk migrate off. So winter count, yeah, it's below objective. Summer, we're probably having more than 1,800 elk there. Again, I mean, that just magnifies the dynamic we have with a migratory population and trying to manage unit by unit within it.
Do we have any more questions from the RAC? Okay, Rusty.
This has been brought up over the years, and the Utah is one of the only states that hunt any weapon when the elk is in the rut. Is there any movement or idea of trying to change that up a little bit somehow, maybe rotation or something? I know it's really tough to do it right cold turkey, but
Yeah. I know, 3 years ago when we had the statewide elk committee, there were conversations about that on that committee, and this was the hunt structure that they wanted to go with. I think one of the dynamics is with archery, muzzleloader, and rifle hunters, they all want a chunk as close to that rut as possible. And so that's where that committee landed with it. I think it's worth having the conversation as far as the division coming forth with a recommendation within the next 2 years. I wouldn't see that likely. I think that's better discussed when we have that committee, when we have the plan to open up and say, what do we feel good about, both the division and the public and the sportsmen, on hunting elk near the rut or in the rut, and setting that framework there. I think that's a better time frame and avenue to do that. So, but there's strong feelings. I've talked to a lot of guys that feel like we should, and I've talked to a lot of guys that feel like we shouldn't. So probably best to get everyone involved. Yeah, and that would be one of the benefits if we did that. So,
any more questions from the RAC? Brian?
On this San Pete County elk, is there a reason why they're taking that away?
Biologically, probably not. We kill probably less than 10 bulls every year. The issue that we have there is there's been a lot of conversation about the Manti is a limited entry unit, and it's hard to draw that permit, and there's some pretty good quality there. And the central region, not just this last year, but the last few years, have got a lot of calls and people in the field saying, you know, I'm waiting, trying to draw this unit, and it's a limited entry. And then you turn around and let guys go buy these permits over the counter and come in and potentially kill one of these bulls. And so there's not good alignment there.
So let me get this straight. There are people that are upset because someone else can buy a tag, and they can buy the same tag, but they're upset.
Essentially.
Awesome.
The major difference would be...
I'm good with that.
Yeah, but not everyone's an archer, and that's what it is.
And I get that. Yeah. I just want to make sure. We're killing less than 10 elk.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Not every recommendation is biological in nature, and I think that we need to be able to admit when it isn't, and this isn't. So.
Okay. One more, and I hate to be talking. I'm sorry, guys. I feel like I... Anyways, recommend that the Wasatch, Box Elder, Lone Peak, and Tippecanoe for the goats all get combined. Uh-huh. My concern, I'm just looking at that. You're saying that they're declining in certain areas. Aren't the hunters just going to go where the most big fluffy goats are and hunt them there? Because if I had that tag, I would just go on the area where the most goats were at.
Yeah. No, you're spot on with that. The problem is when we've done these flights this summer and last summer, a lot of these, they're crossing boundaries. A lot of these mountain goats are actually leaving the Box Elder. They're leaving Lone Peak. And Timp is growing rapidly, and we think it's due to migration. And so what we didn't want to do was issue a few permits, you know, a handful of permits to these guys. They get up there, and all the goats have crossed boundaries. And so what it made more sense to do is say, it's all the same population of goats.
Okay.
Let's have it be one boundary.
So you're saying that those are all essentially the same?
They're neighboring populations.
I get that. So one other question. We manage these goats for 100% success rate.
Yeah, close, yeah.
So why aren't we hunting them a little bit later when you can actually get a goat with some hair? Let that season go a little bit and let these guys that draw the tag get something with hair.
I think with goat hunting, that the only trade-off with that is access. I mean, we can certainly have them later.
Start them the same time, just let them go. And if someone wants to wait and they don't get to hunt, then maybe they made that choice. It's not the division saying you couldn't hunt until November.
Yeah.
They wanted to wait till November.
I'm trying to remember the time frame on the goats. I think it's about 30 days that they get, and that's quite a bit of time for these limited entry hunts. So, but I mean, if the RAC wants to recommend later hunts on these later season dates, that's fine. We want high success rates. So sure.
I get that, yeah. You're managing for that. I just was wondering why they get shut down before October 15th. You know?
Yeah.
Because big fluffy goats need to get big and fluffy.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, We have 35-day season, so, yeah.
Okay. One more time. Any more questions from the rack? Okay. At this time, we'll turn questions over to the public if we have any. We won't call you up. You're free to come up to the mic. Please state your name. And if it's a comment, we'll get to the comment section shortly. So this is for questions only.
Lee Tracy, United Wildlife Cooperative. This is not a statement, but an explanation. I've been involved with that Parowan deer transplant from the get-go, including the planning of it, the range ride, the actual transplant, and now the updates. The only thing I didn't do was go to the release site. I have some questions about having heard now that we're going to do some transplants in January, I have some questions as to why we're doing it so soon. I update on Monster Muleys and Utah Wildlife Forum updates on a regular basis. And the latest update is this. Of the 102 deer that we transplanted, we've lost 45 of them in 48 weeks. That's a little bit less than a week. So if that rate keeps up, next year, at the end of next year, we'll be done. Okay? I have some questions. Why did we decide, first of all, to transplant in January? This coming January, apparently.
Generally, when you do big game transplants, the time that it's most miserable for us, the coldest, is when it's actually best for the animals. And so we're trying to capture deer at the coldest spell. They have a tendency to get real hot and stress and get something called capture myopathy. And if you can minimize that by trapping them in colder months, it's better situation for the deer.
My question is not the fact that we do it in January. I understand that's the best time. Why are we doing it at all?
You know, it's an interesting question because as an agency, it's something that we've been reluctant to do for decades. And I think the best way to answer it is it's really twofold. You have one scenario where lethal removal may or may not be an option, but you need to minimize deer populations, whether they're too stressed on a winter range, whether they're impacting the winter range, the browse that's there, different things like that. You can either call for doe hunts or you can transplant them. And so either way, you're solving a problem on this potential source herd. Now, the flip side of it is you have the potential possibly to bolster a deer herd that historically held more deer, that has adequate winter range, that's away from depredation scenarios, things like that. And we're right now, we're trying to explore that more. We're trying to see if this is something we can do. And it's not just the Parowan front. We have areas like Antelope Island, where they're severely over objective. We're very concerned about habitat damage taking place. And lethal removal simply isn't an option. And so transplanting these deer and taking them off the island is a management tool that our agency would really like to explore. That's why we're doing it.
Okay, there may be some areas. I know that there are a lot of deer up above Bountiful, and they're and a lot of other places, but some of those types of areas, is it Highland? It has a doe hunt over there within city limits, and so there's possibilities for that. You say that it was determined that transplanting would be viable. What do you mean by viable?
Maybe I did say viable. I can't remember the context it was in. It's what it is transplants are a management tool that we'd like to explore. We don't have good data sets in Utah. I can't go back and say in 97 we moved deer from this locale to another one. These were the survival rates, things like that. And you're right. We've lost 44, 45 of the 102 deer that that we've taken off the Parowan front. And there's several ways to look at that. From a biologist's perspective, I don't think I would ever start a population if I knew the initial survival rate is 50%. But as a sportsman, sportsmen look at this and they say, this is a win for us because this is 50% of the deer that are being moved, and otherwise they just would have been killed via a doe hunt or division removal. And so it's really trying to transplant deer, learn as much as we can about it, and see what type of management tool it can be for us.
Okay, let me disclaim that to 50%. We're talking 44% in 10 months. This is a 3-year study. We're not even in 1 year into it, and we've lost almost half of them now. If we're moving to an area that traditionally supported deer, what makes us think that we're going to, and they're not supporting those deer now, what makes us think by moving more deer into it that they're going to support them now? If they haven't supported them for the last little while, there's a reason for it, and moving deer into that isn't going to cure that. What are we doing to make sure that more than just the fact that they're, you know, the areas are remote and yada, 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 what biological steps are we taking? Predator steps are we taking? Testing and those kinds of things that we're taking, besides chronic wasting disease.
Help me understand that question again. Can you simplify that? Essentially, you're asking, what are we doing to ensure this might be successful?
You've designated some areas, but there's some things that that happen to deer because of other reasons other than the fact that, you know, they're eating sagebrush. Number one, their stomachs are very, very species specific. At least the microbes in their stomachs are very species specific. So if you're taken to an area where they're taken from an area where they're eating Wyoming sagebrush and put them on a sagebrush area, they'll starve to death with full stomach. Has this been taken into fact? For instance, to make it viable, the costs, the timing, manpower, and safety all should be considered. And are we looking at things like the elevation, solar orientation, soil composition, geographic orientation, and the specific vegetation? Is that being part of the study?
Yeah. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to represent a variety of locations. We have areas like the West Desert. We have areas like Elk Ridge, the Dutton, things like that. Not all these units are the same. And when we moved deer from the Parowan front up to the Fillmore unit, we were trying to match winter range to winter range. And you're right. I mean, if you take deer that have a high plain nutritional diet off of tulips and things like that, they may not survive as well as some of the other ones that are being moved from a sagebrush area to a sagebrush area. But what we're trying to do is have enough release sites that have variety that we can match those as best as we can. And there's a lot to learn. I don't pretend to have all the answers. We don't have good data sets. This is why it's something that we're trying to explore, learn as much as we can as we move deer from a variety of locations and release them and see what the survival rates are and see what the limiting factors of these are going to be. And then in a few years, we'll be able to better determine what success looks like.
All right, thanks.
Yeah.
Do we have any more questions from the public?
DeLoss Christensen, live in Glenwood, Utah, just representing myself this evening. Thanks for letting us share this time with you again. I have a question. Were any of you that are on the rack tonight, were any of you on the rack in, I think, 2008 when we discussed moving the Monroe from a no spike hunt to a spike hunt. Was it, you were on it, Sam Cornell. I think, Vance, you were with the Richfield region at that time, were you not? Well, if you recall, the result of the meeting in Richfield, when we met on this as a RAC, was to wait and see what the results of an increased harvest on the mature bulls was going to be before we introduced spike hunting on the Monroe. And that evening, the RAC all voted to support to do that, to delay the spike hunt on the Monroe to see what the consequences would be of the additional large bull tags. And the Wildlife Board, because of the other RACs, chose not to do that because they voted not to, not knowing the situation. I believe that was the reason they voted not to. So I guess my question tonight is, and I guess I'd have to direct it to Vance because he was here then. Do you think, Vance, that the concerns we had at that time have been proven to be true in that we don't have the number of mature bulls now that we had then? Is that a yes?
Yes.
Yeah. So you were right in 2008 in your decision, even though others didn't agree with you. And I just wanted to clarify that tonight because we're living now with the results of the decision, not that this RAC made, but others that didn't have the concern but should have had then. So that was my question.
Thank you, Deluxe.
I'm Gene Boardman from Hinckley. My question is that I didn't quite understand what we're trying to do with that pronghorn boundary situation. I'd like it explained just a little more.
Okay.
Was that for the Parker Mount Denton?
Yeah. Oh,
okay. What we have there is that on the southern portion of Johns Valley is split by the Dutton boundary and the Boulder boundary. And what happens there is that those pronghorn just
Dustin,
go on both
you
sides
either,
of the road.
You either need to kneel down or put the mic up.
The pronghorn go on both sides of the road there, and Parker hunters can come down and shoot their pronghorn with their Parker tag in Johns Valley, even though they're not connected to the Parker pronghorn herd. That's a Mount Denton herd. So what we're trying to do there is prevent over-harvest of the Johns Valley herd from Parker hunters and just force Parker hunters to be up on the Parker and allow the Dutton-Ponsagunt hunters access to all of the Johns Valley herd. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Sure.
I'm the same guy I was a minute ago. So, the question has been asked by members of the RAC this evening, if the migration of elk off adjacent units may not be satisfactory increase, so that the harvest of 165 bulls, spike bulls, is not in or causing a reduction in the mature bull population that the age class management objective would have. And I think we've had quite a bit of discussion tonight about that migration from the adjacent units, particularly the Dutton. And I think from my understanding is collared elk indicate that there may be some 300 head or 30% of that unit moving over onto the Monroe. And so you might conclude that, in fact, we're bringing spikes on the unit. But the thing that I want to make clear is, through a question to Vance again, Vance, do we have elk leaving the Monroe going to other units like they're coming on to the unit from the Dutton?
Yep, good question, and we absolutely have elk that leave the Monroe that winter there, and elk that jump back and forth in all different directions. I think an actual just to kind of summarize it, I think we if we look at the number of spikes that are harvested on Monroe, the number of spikes that we count in the winter tells us that we do have a net gain of elk in the summer. In other words, we definitely have more elk in the summer than we do in the winter. But to pin that down, you know, we don't know, and that's why we do the winter population estimate.
So to clarify again, we know how many are coming on from the Dutton, from the ratios of the collared elk, but we do not know how many are leaving because we don't have Monroe elk collared. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so it is possible, although maybe not likely, but possible, that more spikes leave the Monroe than come on?
Yeah, DeLoss, anything's possible, but probably not likely, looking at our harvest numbers.
Would you say that there may be some equity? Or do you think we're gaining?
I think, again, looking at our harvest numbers, we are gaining over the 1,400.
Yeah. During the summer?
During the summertime.
Okay, thanks.
Sure, go ahead.
Hey, while you're up there, Vance, didn't you make the comment that in the summertime we have 1,800 head elk on the Monroe? In the winter, we have like 14?
You know, that would be a real rough estimate. You know, the number we can pin down is 1,400. Then we look at approximately a third of those Dutton elk are coming over. And so we're adding several hundred.
Okay, so probably 400 head of elk. Let's just say half of them are cows, okay? Half are bulls. Out of that percentage, you got 25% that are spike, okay? That still leaves 100 head of elk off of either the Fish Lake, the Beaver, or the Dutton, correct? They're going to be there during the summer months because they're not going to leave until October till they get shot at.
Yeah, you know, the studies, I think, show that those elk start trickling off in early September, but the big movement of elk is, later in October and November.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Do we have any more questions from the public? Okay, we'll move to the comment section from the rack. Do we have comments from the rack? Lane? No, we have public comments first.
Yeah, public comments.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
We'll do the public comments first. And so before we start, I have three cards that I'd like to read where they've requested not to come to the mic. Jason Aiken with the Iron County SFW, and he indicates that Iron County SFW supports the DWR's recommendations.
Supports the SFW recommendation.
Oh, excuse me. Supports the SFW recommendation, which is, we don't have that yet.
Do we? Okay,
here's Bryce's recommendation. Should have read this one first. Bryce Pilling, Sportsman of Fish and Wildlife, indicates that they support the DWR's recommendation, therefore Iron County also supports DWR's recommendation. And then I have a comment card from Kevin Williams. His comment is regarding meat processing, where he indicates that if your meat is in processed by a butcher, to stamp the meat instead of keeping the tag with the meat, unless you butcher your own meat.
Did you want to comment on that anymore, Kevin, or I don't know that I did you justice? Okay, so you're looking for a change that... Okay. Okay, thank you. Okay, and now we'll move to the comment cards. First one is John Keeler, and then followed by John will be Lee Tracy. What we'd like to do, especially since we have such a large agenda, if you're representing a sportsman or a group, you'll have 5 minutes to comment. If you're representing an individual, you'll have 3 minutes to comment, and we can only have one representative per group. Otherwise, you'd be counted as an individual.
John Keeler, Utah Farm Bureau. I serve on a Monroe Mountain Aspen Working Group, and one of the problems that we have on the Monroe Mountain is lack of recruitment of young Aspen into the Aspen community. And part of that problem is grazing pressure, and so we've been looking at ways to minimize that pressure. And one of the things that's talked about is of course regulating the numbers of ungulates on the mountain. There's been presentation made to the RAC and the Wildlife Board from the Monroe Mountain Group, trying to educate the public as to the problem. And so I think it's important that we take a look at all the permit numbers on that mountain as it relates to this aspen problem. And so I think it would be ill-advised to discontinue the spike any weapon hunt, is we need to keep that pressure on those numbers so that that keeps the pressure off the aspen grazing. It's a big problem, not only there but other places, and I think we need to address that problem, and any ways we can do that, I think we should. So we would recommend that you continue the spike any weapon hunt.
Thank you. Lee? And then followed by Lee, we'll have Gene Boardman.
United Wildlife Cooperative recommends that we accept the provisions that have been shown and been presented, with one exception, and that's the or with one disclaimer at least. We'll accept and support the process of transplanting deer, but with a disclaimer that we need to understand that if we're moving deer to prevent depredation solely, to prevent depredation and habitat damage, we accept that. If we're moving them for the main purpose of trying to upgrade or improve the population in another unit, we oppose those kinds and recommend that we don't transplant for those reasons at all. We also are concerned about the fact that if we start doing as much transplanting as maybe we think we ought to, we'll eliminate a lot of doe hunts, and we're opposed to that as well.
Thank you. Gene, and then followed by Gene, we have Paul Niemeyer.
Okay, Gene Boardman, Hinckley, Utah. I've got two or three things I'd like to talk about. One, it's always interesting that as soon as they start talking about taking pressure off from the game, the first thing that they go to is the any weapons hunt. Sometimes it'd be a good idea for everybody to have skin in the game, or proportion it out. Maybe the any weapons hunt is the way to go. And I guess you can always get one of those shoulder cannons if you really want to chase them. But we're kind of any weapons hunters. It's just kind of interesting that that's always the first option is the any weapons. I'd like to see something done different about the way that the draw, the timing of when you have to apply for hunts in this state, and how long it takes for the results to come out, especially on the bucks, bulls, and once in a lifetime. Some of the other hunts, they seem to be able to go from the draw to the results in about 3 weeks. And this one takes, what, 70, 80, 90 days? And have it at a different time of the year. I'm not sure why it has to be done in the winter and early spring. And the other thing is that it's kind of a, put your applications in and then we'll decide later whether there's a hunt there for you or how many tags there's going to be available. It seems to me that we need to really look at what we've got and see if there isn't a better way to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Paul, and then followed by Paul is DeLoss.
I'm Paul Niemeyer. The history on this meeting at the head on the Monroe Elk a few weeks ago, it was actually recommended by this RAC a year ago that we asked the board, the RAC would ask the board to look at the Monroe hunt. So then the board did pass that down to DWR. So that was where the meeting came. Now, I don't know if everybody didn't get notice or what. There was quite a lot of people there. There's county commissioners there. There's some RAC members there. There was people from all over the public. There was people from the Elk Committee, but it was pretty well attended. And the one thing that came to light, and some of them didn't agree on what we should do, but the one thing that did come is we can't harvest these elk on that unit the way we are and have any quality bulls left. Now, some years ago, that was the pride of Utah. That was one of the best units probably in the Western United States. It is very accessible. It will not take a lot of pressure, which we've proved that now. I live on that unit. I grew up on that unit. I lived there before there was elk there. Hate to tell you all that. But at any rate, we have taken that with too many probably mature bull tags and easy access, and then now with the spy counts. But last year, we're hunting them right now, but the vote was for 244 cow tags on the Monroe. Then you got depredation, mitigation, and it's an either-sex archery hunt. Then on the north end of Dutton, there's about 500 cow tags scattered through this fall and in early winter. So we've got a unit or an elk population that the objective is 1,800 winter count. We figure there's 1,400 now. We can all argue about what goes on and off and from what direction, but that is the management plan that's there now. Right now, we're harvesting more spikes on the Monroe than on the Fish Lake. The Fish Lake's got four times the objective is the Monroe. So that kind of illustrates the way that they can kill these spikes. Now, in that meeting, there was, I'd say everybody wanted to do something to improve the bull harvest on that, the older age bulls, into more quality. The two recommendations that came out of that, one was to just don't hunt spikes, period, And the other one was to go to that archery and muzzleloader only. And then it went up to through the DWR process and through their people, and that's where we came, or they came to the recommendation for archery and muzzleloader.
Can you wrap that up for us, Paul?
Pardon?
You're running out of time. Can you wrap that up for us? I'm sorry.
Say that again.
We're running out of time. We have
okay. Well, basically, where we're at is there was a lot of people there. They're not happy with seeing the bull quality get to where it is. And so that was the two recommendations that came out. The DWR is recommending to you that you go to muzzleloader or to archery. And that's how the history of that came through. So I'd say you guys voted for that a year ago to look at it. They looked at it. The board looked at it, and then they brought it back to the rack. So that's the history.
Thank you. That was very useful. Appreciate that. Loss?
Thanks again. I sit on the same Aspen work group committee that John mentioned. In fact, he and I were in the same room from about 8:30 until 4:30 today together on that committee. And just to assure you, there is concern over aspen regeneration on the mountain, but we are not asking for more elk. We're simply asking for a distribution that's different. So I agree with John. We're staying with the elk management number. In fact, we're quite a ways beneath what the elk management plan says we can have on the unit. And I recognize that there's trade-offs. If we're going to have more spikes and more bulls that are branch antler and bigger on that unit, at some point in time, we'll have to decide that we'll have to have less cows. But we're not at the number that the system has said we can have there yet. So while I'm concerned about that, I'm not concerned about it at this time, because we're under that objective. And with taking the cows off the unit this year and probably some more next year, we'll see. The number of elk up there isn't a concern. I was one that attended the meeting. I wasn't invited. I heard about it, and I attended like anyone else have. And I know there was 8 or 9 people around me that just showed up to that meeting because they were concerned. The truth of the matter was there was a straw poll taken at the meeting by the gentleman from the division who conducted the meeting. And two-thirds would have rather had no spike hunting on the Monroe at all. And the other third voted to do the recommendation that the division's recommended here today. So I think what you're seeing is a compromised recommendation. And we support that. I support that. I'm supporting the division's recommendation. And I want to thank them for working with those of us who are not only emotionally attached to this, but hunt and live on that mountain and know what's happened and the changes that have taken place there. So we recognize that this isn't maybe what the majority of sportsmen would like, but we also recognize that it's a step. There's no reason we can't come back here in a couple years if it's not adequate and ask you to take another step forward, and we may do that. But we're willing to say, if you'll grant us this opportunity, to let's see what will happen if we restrict this to archery and muzzleloader hunting. Now, the truth is, we may not lose any opportunity. In fact, there's been chatter on the internet that lots and lots of people with muzzleloaders and archers will come down on the Monroe this next year to hunt spikes.
Can you wrap that up for us, Dallas?
Yeah, for a lot of different reasons. So I'm not suggesting there'll be less people hunting there. There'll be less rifle hunters. But, again, thank you to the division and your support, and I hope the RAC will support us tonight on this as well. Thanks again.
The last comment card I have for this item is from Braden Richmond. Have I missed anybody? Okay.
Brayden Richmond, representing the SFW Fulfillment Board. Just a little clarification. The SFW State Fulfillment Board, we want to support the division's recommendations as is, and frankly, really are happy with the recommendations they're bringing up, with one small exception and a little bit of clarification. On the Monroe unit, we did a non-vote on that. We don't either disapprove of it or support it. In fact, just to clarify, our discussion there was we didn't feel like we had enough information being a statewide board versus what the local area had. So that's the state's opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Braden. Okay, with no more comment cards, we'll move to comments from the RAC. Lane?
I just have one comment. I was at that meeting in Richfield on the Monroe spike, and just to concur what the comments made by DeLoss and Paul, there was support. There is concern with the local people in Sevier County with the spike harvest on the Monroe. And it was a consensus that night, and I pretty much sat in the back of the room and didn't say much. I wanted to hear what the local people had to say. There was a consensus that night that there is a concern there for the over-harvest of the spikes on the Monroe. And something that came out that didn't really come out of the meeting, but some of the guys that were sitting back there around me felt like that the Monroe was almost called the second weekend unit. A lot of guys were hunting the Fish Lake or the Boulder or the Beaver the first weekend, and when they're not successful, they're let's go to the Monroe, it's easy, we'll go kill one over there. And I think that is a valid concern, that the Monroe is an easy unit to hunt, and when they're unsuccessful on some of the other units, the hunters are migrating to the Monroe. And the support from, you know, from some of the elected officials that were there, they all want to see something done with that hunt, and that's what I got out of that meeting was we just need to do something. And so the recommendation that's where the recommendation came from that have presented here tonight. Thanks.
Thank you, Lane, for that report. Any other comments? Sean?
Yeah, I thought I better chime in from the forest standpoint about the aspen regeneration. That's been a major issue with us, but our understanding is, and it won't change the population objective in the unit. In other words, your objective, any increase or decrease in bull harvest can be made up by an increase in cow harvest. From a biologist standpoint, I'd much rather see the cows die. It's like a 2-for-1. I don't know why, but dead cows don't have as many calves. And so, you know, from that standpoint, we see no issue at all in the aspen regen.
Okay. Claire, you're thinking. You have a comment? Anybody else? Dale?
So I was at the meeting also in Richfield. I'm not sure how I got invited because there's definitely a divide. More people on the Paiute side of that unit like the spike hunt. I agree there is a problem. They are taking a lot of spikes off there, but I think it's twofold. You have basically admitted that for 3 years the increase was there on the mature bulls. They upped them heavily, and then they shut it down, slammed it, and raised the age objective. Well, you do that, yeah, you're not going to make the age objective for several years. It takes a lot of years to grow those bulls. I really don't care if we stop the spike hunt, but we can't just sit on a ton of bulls like we did for the past 15 years until we get to that point where we got to hurry and harvest a bunch because we're at objective. You're going to have to take some bulls off that top end while you're saving a bunch of spikes. I will tell you one thing, that spike hunt has upped the pressure on those elk in the valleys, and that's the only thing that finally drives them out of the valley. It doesn't matter if you do a spike hunt, you can do a big cow hunt, as long as you do something to get those elk out of the valley. And that's a choice I guess you all can make when it comes to that point.
Thank you. Any more comments? Are you ready, Claire?
You twisted my arm.
You're going to miss your turn. We're going to move on if you don't have a comment.
Yeah, I do. All of you out there know that I'm one of the biggest proponents of elk and the way the state of Utah has managed elk in the last 30 years. I think we've done a fantastic job. When I started hunting elk in the 1970s, if you saw an elk, it was celebration time around the campfire. And now our main problem is, you know, how do we keep the numbers down? I think the spike hunt has done what we wanted it to do. We were stockpiling bulls to where we would have to shoot the cows to get to objective. Have we gone too far on the Monroe? I don't know. I don't know. I look at the overall numbers. The 2010 count, we had 1,100. The 2013 count, we had 1,400. We've increased the herd by 300. And if we're taking that many spikes, then that 300 would be cows. Those cows, if they have the typical 50% calves, that means there's 150 calves, which 75 of those would have been spike bulls this year, 75 more spike bulls than we had in 2010. That would explain a lot of why we had so much more spike kill this year. We had a lot more spikes on that mountain, just doing the math. That said, I don't know what I would recommend or what I would follow as far as just going, getting rid of the any weapon hunt. On the deer transplants, you know, Lee brought up a lot of good questions, but it keeps coming back to if we don't transplant them, we have the doe hunts, we have 100% mortality on those does. As it is, we've had 40 to 45% mortality. And that wouldn't take into consideration the fawns that those does had this year. We've got, those aren't tagged or collared, the fawns that they dropped in April and May. So we have more than just the 58 does left. We have the 58 does plus what fawns they dropped. We're right back up near that 100 number that we transplanted. And those fawns that were born this year are now resident deer in that Fillmore area. They're not transplanted, they're resident now. So I would be all for continuing these doe transplants. I think that's a great idea. And that's all I have.
Okay, do you have any further comments?
I got one.
Okay, Mac.
I find it kind of ironic that you want to combine units on the goats, but yet you don't want to combine any units on the elk between the Fish Lake, Dutton, Monroe, and Boulder. Plus you have an Aspen study going on. Plus you already got some collared elk study going on. I don't know why that you'd want to change in the middle of the game. Why not wait 2 years and then make some changes? And like Dale mentioned, Paiute County has a major problem in the wintertime with elk in the fields and all, and you'd have to see it to find out what's happening there. They had to build fences, they had to shoot bulls, they had to do everything. And they're coming from the Monroe. So I think you just will leave it status quo for 2 years, and then that way the Aspen study will be done, then you'll find out what the results are.
Thank you, Mac. Okay, let me just summarize real quick. The way I see it, there's three main items that have been brought up and discussed, and if you'd like, we can deal with these three items before we move on to the main motion, and those are: the first one is the spike elk hunt on the Monroe, if we're going to keep it as is or if we're going to eliminate the any weapon hunt. And it looks like from the comment cards that we have
two that were for and two that were against. The other item that was brought up is the timing of the draw, too long to get the results. And the third item was that we don't require the tag to stay with professionally processed meat. And so those are three items. We can, if there's anybody that'd like to bring those up, let's maybe address those separately, and then we can move on to the main motion. Let's maybe talk about the spike elk hunt now. Is there anybody that would like to comment any further or ready to make a motion? Lane?
I would make a motion that we accept the division's recommendation on the mineral spike hunt to eliminate the any weapon hunt and maintain the archery and the muzzleloader hunt.
Okay. We have a motion from Lane. Do we have a second? Okay. We have a second from Mike. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Go ahead, Brian.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a motion to amend Lane's motion. I hate to see us lose that opportunity for the general public to hunt that Monroe spike elk hunt. I would make the motion that we keep all three hunts at the regular dates, but to further compromise, as the division has put it, leave that those dates open that would generally be in the any weapon to primitive weapon.
Okay. Do we have a second on the amendment?
I want some clarification.
Yeah.
Okay. You want to restate that?
First 2 weeks of October is the rifle or the any weapon spike hunt. I say we leave that open on the Monroe, but you must use an archery or a muzzle loader. We will still have the opportunity to hunt them, but just increase the difficulty level and give people the opportunity to go up there.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I think Robert Rules of Order come in. I don't think that he can amend my motion to make my motion null and void.
Lane, he has to have a second on his amendment, and then we vote on the amendment, and we'll come back to the original motion.
Okay.
So what we need to do right now is we need to ask for a second on the amendment, and if we get a second, we'll vote on the amendment first, and then if the amendment is successful, then that amends the original motion, and then we vote on that motion after that.
Okay. Right now we have an amendment to the motion from Claire. Do we have a second on that motion, on that amendment? Okay, we have a second from Brian. Do we have any discussion on the amendment?
I'm with Claire on this. I hate to see opportunity go away. You're not going to increase the number of elk that get killed, really. You're just letting them hunt for an extra 2 weeks, which, you know, as long as we're not shooting them at 300 yards with high powered rifles, I think that will accomplish what everybody else here is trying to do. So I think it's actually a pretty good amendment there. Thanks, Claire.
Any further discussion? Okay, do we need to restate this amendment? Is everybody clear on the amendment? Okay.
I would recommend that we amend Lane's motion to keep the Monroe Mountain spike elk hunt dates open on, but only for the use of primitive weapons, muzzleloader or archery. That is in that 2 week period early October.
During the dates of the any weapon hunt, allow the use of primitive weapons on the Monroe.
During the dates of the any weapons hunt, first 2 weeks of October, when that normally happens.
Sure. Sam?
Yeah, the one thing that I see in doing what you wanted to do, Claire, is how many hunters that have these tags going to show up there? You know, if you have one unit on the state that's going to have muzzle and archery hunt going on for an extra couple of weeks, you're going to get inundated with a ton of hunters up there during that period of time. It's going to really, you know, could have an impact. I know it's not going to kill any more elk than the tags permit, but the hunt quality would be probably quite a crowd. I imagine a lot of people would want to go do that if you did, you know, change that date.
Well, if there's 165 spikes getting shot during those 2 weeks, I think that mountain's inundated.
Let me just a brief comment, Claire. I appreciate what you're trying to do. It does bring up some issues with licensing and law enforcement when we sell a tag that says any weapon tag on it, but then we're only allowing them to use a certain number because that's a statewide tag. And so that's something that we'll have to have. I'm sure there'll be some discussion on that issue at the Wildlife Board while our licensing folks are there. And I don't know if that's something that's doable from their standpoint and from a law enforcement standpoint or not. But I appreciate what you're trying to accomplish.
I'm just a question. Wouldn't, as far as discussion go, we're selling a statewide spike tag anyways. We've got to change if this goes through, we're changing the Monroe anyways. Correct?
Right, but we'd just be closing it during those dates instead of allowing someone keeping it open but only allowing primitive weapons during an any weapon hunt. It may be doable. I'm just saying it's gonna generate some discussion with our law enforcement and our licensing folks. And I don't know where to end because we haven't had those conversations yet.
Okay. Justin?
Sorry to chime in. One more thing to consider. I think in the past we've had cow rifle hunts at that same time. And if this recommendation went with having primitive weapons, we can do away with those cow hunts. We can do them at different times. We can get creative that way, but something to consider that normally with those spike hunts, you have cow hunts going on with rifles at the same time. So just a thought.
Thank you.
Do we allow a comment from the
Paul?
I know that
I believe we're in the middle of a vote up here. I think point of order here, Mr. Chairman. We're in the middle of a vote on up here with the RAC only.
I know that on the board level, the Wildlife Board level, we've allowed discussion before the vote. And I think that it's valid to have Paul give his comments right now.
The only comment I've got is the idea behind here was kind of limit the spike hunts in some way. And if you put everybody in the state of Utah could come in here and hunt archery or muzzleloader during that regular hunt, I think that would pull more hunters in and probably not do what we were really looking to do.
Thank you. Okay, are we ready to take a vote on the amendment? And this is only to the amendment. All those in favor? All those opposed? Okay, do I have a count? Okay, so the amendment dies. We're back to the main motion. Do we have any more discussion on the main motion? Okay, let's vote on the main motion. And the main motion is to
support the division's recommendation.
Support the division's recommendation as presented.
Relative to spike cunning on the Monroe.
Relative to spike cunning on the Monroe. Sure.
I just want to make a comment on this Monroe thing, and I agree with Dale, okay? But this hunt, and I live in Paiute County, okay? I know people that hunted on the Monroe, at least 10 guys that never even saw a spike, okay? What I'm saying here, okay, if this motion passes, then when we come up with the elk plan, I don't want to see the same group of people back in here. I want to see what has happened, okay, in this next 2 years, that if this has helped, it has hindered, or it hasn't done one drop of good. Okay, I don't know how I do that, but I will bring it back up again, because we have fought this battle. Elk on the Monroe come from the Fish Lake, come from the Dutton, okay, the Monroe, and I don't think we kill any more elk, percentage-wise, Monroe elk, during that spike hunt, than we do on any other mountain. I've hunted the Monroe. I live there. Okay, right at the bottom of it. I live on right between the Dutton, Monroe, and the Beaver. Okay? I know if it was up to me, I'd say we do what we're keep doing. But I will, okay, honor what the DWR wants to do. But in 2 years, I don't want this same group of people coming back here saying, well, guess what? It didn't help one drop. So now we got to drop the spike tag again. I want to see this issue come back up again. Thank you.
Thanks for your comment. Okay, let's have a vote. All those in favor? All those opposed? Okay, let's do one more time. All those in favor, hold your hands up. All those opposed? Okay. The motion dies. Okay, that has to do with the spike. There was two other items, and you can choose if we want to bring those up at this time or not. And that was, again... Okay. Mike, do you have a motion for it?
I make a motion to keep the spike hunt as it has been and do the status quo.
Okay. And we have a motion by Mike and a second by Dale. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Just to be clear, you're just talking about till the end of the plan and we revisit this in 2 years, Mac? Is that what the intent is?
That's when this would be addressed in 2 years. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor? Yes, we do. We have a second by Dale. Okay. All those in favor? All those opposed? Motion carries. Okay. Before we get to the remainder of the plan, you can choose if you want to bring up a motion either regarding the timing of the draw and or the tag requiring to stay with the professional process meet.
I don't have a motion considering those, but I would love to make a motion on goat hunts.
Okay, go ahead.
I would like to see those go until December 1st.
Okay, do we have a second on the motion?
What are the dates now, Brian?
I'd have to look. I think it's
approximately.
Like
approximately.
Give me a ballpark. September 1st to the end of September.
Yeah, generally September 8th through October 12th, and there's a little bit of variation depending on very individual hunts.
And the reason I bring this up is because these are generally in areas that don't overlap with other hunters. They're managing for 100% success. And if these guys choose to wait till the very end and they don't get access to the mountain, then that was their once-in-a-lifetime shot. Shame on them. So I don't know. We're managing for 100%.
Do we have a second on the motion? Okay, we have a second by Rusty. Do we have any discussion on the motion?
I would like to ask a question. I'm not real knowledgeable on the goats. You say they get hairy or fluffy.
Did they grow a winter coat later in the season is what I'm asking.
Yeah,
and that's very desirable.
Very. Yeah, that's what's going on is the longer the hunt goes, the more hairier they get and the better looking they are. Flip side is you may not get up on the mountain to kill them.
Go ahead.
If I may, I think one reason that it hasn't been recommended much further than October 12th in the past is the rut starts that time in November and those types of time frames, and some populations may rut a little bit earlier. Again, that's but where you land with that, I don't know. We just talked about hunting elk in the rut, so just something to consider as to why it hasn't gone that far in the past. So,
okay, Brian.
They rut in November, but we're still managing for 100% success.
Okay.
So.
Any further discussion? Okay, let's take a vote. All those in favor of Brian's motion to extend the season of the goat hunt to December 1st. All those in favor? All those opposed? And then did we have an abstention or are we all add up? Okay. Motion fails. Okay, the two other concerns which were brought up one more time before we move on was the tag with the meat and the timing of the draw as far as the results coming too long after the submittal of the application.
I've never heard of any problems with the tag being left with the meat in the freezer. I say we ignore it.
No, we don't have to do we don't have to do anything on either one of those. So if that is the case and the desire, then we can move on. We need to address the remainder of the plan that was presented with the Bucks Bulls once-in-a-lifetime season dates and application timeline.
I make a motion that we pass the balance of the division's recommendations.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Motion from Brian, second from Rusty. Do we have any discussion on the motion? All those in favor? That looks unanimous. Okay. Let's move on. Thank you. We're on item number 6, which is the CWMU management plans and the permit numbers for 2014, and Scott McFarland is going to present that for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, board members. Good evening. My name is Scott McFarland. I'm the Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator for the division. And this evening I will be presenting the 2014 Buck and Bull CWMU and Landowner Association recommendations. Just to begin with, every year we receive three different types of applications for the CWMUs. The first one would be a new application. Obviously, that's one that is brand new that has never been in the system. They've never been a CWMU before. Or it could be an application where they've changed land ownership or their acreage that is greater than 34%. That kicks them back into a new category where they have to reapply. Also, we receive renewal applications. Our CWMUs are on a three-year renewal cycle. Every 3 years they need to renew if they wish to stay in the program. And the last one would be change applications. Our CWMUs do have the ability to change on a yearly basis certain aspects of their applications and management plans. The things that require RAC or board approval are any change in permit numbers, or the permit allocation or the public-private split in those, or any change in season dates, that has to go through the RAC and board. So for 2014, we had four new applications. Two of those were due to land ownership changes greater than 34%. There were two brand new applications, had never been CWMUs before. 13 CWMUs required were up for renewal there at the end of their three-year application period, and 7 CWMUs submitted change applications that they either changed their permit number, season dates, or permit splits. If approved, that would make, if all of them were approved that are presented tonight, that would make a total of 119 CWMUs for the 2014 hunting season. Just as an overview, just as an informational, like I said, there's 119 proposed CWMUs for 2014. That would make 72 in the northern region. Northeastern region would have 5. The central region would have 12. Southeastern, 17. The southern region would have 13 CWMUs. There's over 2.16 million acres enrolled in the program, and 96% of that, of which 96% is private lands. There's a little more than that. There's a little more than 446 private landowners that participate in the CWMU program. Okay, so the 2014 CWMU buck and bull permit recommendations are, and this is just a total number for all the CWMUs. There would be, and this will change a little bit. I'll explain that. There's been some changes since this was put together. But buck deer, there would be 1,926 private, 255 public. Management buck permits would be four private, one public, 885 bull elk, private and 131 public. Buck pronghorn would be 76 private and 54 public, and bull moose 46 private and 28 public, with a total of 2,937 private permits on all the species and 469 public permits, which represent about 14%. I'll go through the recommendations by region. Northern region had three of the new applications, the Grouse Creek Hardscrabble and TL Bar Ranch. The division recommends approval of all of those. They had quite a few renewal applications, the Blue Creek, Grass Valley, Clark Canyon, Jacobs Creek, Lazy H Ranch, Mountaintop, Neal Creek, Stillman Creek Ranch, TJ Cattle Company, and Woodruff Creek South, and we recommend approval of all those. We had several change applications in the northern region. White's Valley, we have a slight change. We had a clerical error when we were calculating the public's compensation for public land being included in the CWMU, and they requested an amendment to their application. What they wanted to do is decrease their buck deer permits. They were at 20. They originally requested 13 permits, 11-2. They wanted to drop that back down to, there's no decrease in public permits. There would be, they wanted to go that to 8-2 and decrease their private permits even further. And I will, after I finish these, I will go back to the total numbers and tell you what change that is. Deseret had some addition of private property they added, and they also added some permits. And they asked to change their public-private split, the ratio of public to private permits on their bull elk, from 85-15 to a 90-10 split. And what that does is that gives the public 100% of the antlerless permits, elk antlerless permits that are offered on there, which currently is about 260 antlerless permits that the public will receive. The Washakie, Nucor West, and Ingham Peak, they had changes where they're adding or decreasing buck deer permits, and Ingham Peak added elk to their CWMU because of an increasing population of that elk in that area. We recommend approval of all of those. Southeastern region, We had three applications. One was a new application for Spring Canyon. It's a new one. It would be a Deer CWMU only. The division recommends denial of the application. It is because of insufficient contiguous acreage to make up the 5,000 acres. I do have a map if there are questions on that, but it doesn't fit the rule, and I can explain that later if you'd like. Red Ranches, it's a renewal. Red Ranches and Minimod Ridge, they're both renewals. The division recommends approval of the Red Ranches, Minimod Ridge, CWMU. We recommend approval of the application without the inclusion of a state section in there. This was taken out previously by the board at the recommendation of the board. They're asking to have it put back in, but it really doesn't fit. There is public access to this, and it previously has been taken out of that. So what the division would recommend is approval of the application without the inclusion of that state section 2 and the corresponding numbers. They would request, there's no change in the private permits, but there's a decrease in the public permits available if that's done. Southern Region applications, there's Emma Park, or Southeastern Region, excuse me. Emma Park is a renewal, and Schofield Canyon is a change. We recommend approval of both of those. The change on Schofield Canyon is they want to decrease the buck deer permits to reflect population decrease. So, Southern Region, there's Black Point and Oak Ranch. Black Point's a renewal. They're approved. There's really no changes from the previous application. Oak Ranch, we have a change in that. They would like to withdraw their change application for the same reason. What happened was the public land that was included was not compensated for with permits in this change right there. It should have been 12 and 3, and they requested that they just withdraw the application and keep the extra public permit on there and also the private permits. So that would be a change. Let's see. What would this do to the total overall CWMU permit numbers? It would increase the private permits by one from the posted numbers here, and also the public permits would be increased by one. So it would be 2,938 and 470 is what that would change that to. Thank you.
Oh, excuse me. Do you have any questions from the RAC? Okay. Do we have any questions from the public? Okay. Comments. I have comment cards. I had one that I want to read. This is from the Executive Board of the Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, and it states that they support the DWR's recommendations on these items. And then I have a comment card from Wade Heaton, followed by John Keeler.
Wade Heaton, representing the CWMU Association, as well as myself. We support the DWR's recommendations. Obviously not all of the CWMUs are up this year for renewal or changes, but we support all the changes and the renewals that are happening right now. CWMU Association has been able to work really close with Scott especially. He's been wonderful to work with, and things are really, right now we're pretty optimistic the direction we're going with the CWMU program. Things really do look good. We're trying to change a little bit of public perspective. We've got a little uphill battle to go with some of that, but we are making some headway. I think for the most part, the CWMUs understand the privilege they've got and are willing to work and make it work for everybody. Anyway, I want to appreciate you for your time and thank you.
Thank you, Wade. John?
John Keeler, Utah Farm Bureau. The Farm Bureau supports the CWMU Management Plan Program and the Landowner Permits Program and support the division's recommendations. Thank you.
Okay. That's all the comment cards. Do we have any comments from the rack? If we don't have any comments, we're ready to entertain a motion.
I'd like to make a motion that we accept EWR's proposal as presented.
We have a second by Sean. Okay, do I have any discussion on the motion? With no discussion, we'll move to a vote. All those in favor? It's unanimous. Okay, we'll move on to the next item, which is the landowner permit numbers for 2014, and that'll be presented to us by Scott.
Thank you. This will be the Landowner Association voucher recommendations. This year we received 14 applications. The division recommends approval of 10 applications as we receive them, and there are four split recommendations. Excuse me, I got to make sure we have the right one on here just a second. We did send in a different, apparently it wasn't posted on here. There was a revision to the PowerPoint presentation. There should be, what it should be is 15 applications were received, and the DWR recommends the approval of 11 of those, and we had four split recommendations of one of those which has been resolved. So. They sent out another one. Okay. Right. This one, what we did is had another one more.
I printed the slides for the RAC members.
Okay. You have the updated version? Okay. Okay. Thank you. Try not to make a mistake here. And anyways, there's 15 applications and whatever.
We'll go through those.
So it'll be 14 landowner associations. Only that should be 15. There should be I believe it says 115 deer on there. One of the changes, it was an oversight. We had the Henry Mountains Landowner Association that qualifies for one deer permit every 3 years. In 2014, they came up for their one deer permit. And so we're recommending approval of that. It would be one management buck voucher, 76 elk vouchers, and now 8-pound prong horse vouchers to the landowner associations. We had several recommendations that were differing. What we have is what the landowner associations request and then what they qualify for and what the division recommends. The Vernon Landowner Association is a buck deer unit, and they qualify for 28 permits. They requested 35. They request 35 every year because that's how many landowners they have in the association. The DWR recommends 28 of those.
And the reason being is that there's a reduction in the unit permits. The landowner associations qualify for whatever percentage of land they have in the unit as the percentage of the permits that are offered there, and that's why the reductions. The Ponsagant Landowner Wildlife Association, they get management buck deer permits. They requested four. They qualify for one because of a reduction in those unit permits, and the division recommends one on that. The Panguitch Lake Bull Elk has been resolved. The Landowner Association agrees with the seven permits that were recommended, and they qualify for. Indian Peaks Landowner Association, they ask every year for three premium permits. It's not a dispute over the number, just whether they can be premium permits or not. The rule doesn't allow them to do that. The premium permits would allow them to hunt all the seasons. And so we recommend just staying with the regular permits on those. Thank you. Also, I might add that we were going to present part of the landowner rule, an amendment to that, a change to that rule, but because it wasn't specifically identified in the agenda, we're choosing to do that in November. We'll be coming back with that through the next RAC tour. Thank you.
Do we have any questions from the RAC? Okay.
Is there a minimum acreage for landowner permit?
There's not a minimum. Yeah, there is a minimum acreage. The landowner associations have to enroll at least 51% of the private lands within the limited entry unit. So there's a minimum acreage, but it's corresponding to the amount of private land that is within the limited entry unit. So does that make sense?
Somewhat, I guess. So you're talking about 51% of the landowners have to agree, then it gets in.
Yeah, acreage-wise. Yeah, for example, if there's 100,000 private land acres within the limited entry unit, they would have to come up with 51,000 of those, a simple majority of 51% of those acreage to qualify to be in a landowner association.
Do you have any additional questions? Do we have any questions from the public? Comment card-wise, I have a comment card from the Executive Board of the Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. They are in support of the DWR's recommendation on this item. Okay, I have two comment cards. The first one is Wade Heaton, and the second one is Jeremy Chamberlain.
Just real brief, representing Friends of the Ponsagant. We've talked about this management hunt several times in the past. The hunt has worked the way we had all envisioned it to work. It's accomplished its goals. It's lowered the buck-to-doe ratio, which is the trigger that moves the permit numbers. And so our buck-to-doe ratio has fallen within the objective, and it has been, we all agreed to the fact that as it fell within the objective, we're going to lower permit numbers. So we've accomplished our goal. We're to the point, we're to the stage where we're starting to lower permit numbers. And so we wholeheartedly agree with the DWR's recommendation, both not that we're recommending public tags today, but on the landowner side as well as the public side, obviously those two entities need to move together, whether it's down or up. Those numbers for the private and the landowners need to move together. And the permit numbers have already dropped for the private end or public end. Private tags need to do the same thing. We all agreed to this in advance. And we're just to that next stage. One of the problems is the Landowner Association hasn't been real involved, to be honest with you. We'll throw them under the bus just a smidgen. But they just haven't been real involved. And so they're lagging behind just a little bit. Kind of hurts me to see the split recommendation, but it is what it is. We certainly do support the division's recommendation, though. Thanks.
Okay.
State what your name, please. Oh,
Jeremy Chamberlain with the Friends of the Ponsignant. What I'd like to comment on is just how well this process has worked for the Ponsignant unit. I think it's been 3 years ago we made the recommendation to the RAC. The RAC passed it, went to the big game board. And, you know, the recommendation, if I remember correctly, was to actually allocate this number of permits for a trophy hunt. And it was fun to see and be involved in how this process has worked to where we as sportsmen united ourselves with the RAC and the fish and game and got that changed from, I think it was 50, if I remember right. Dustin Mike can help me, but this number of permits was going to go to a trophy hunt and have, you know, dispersing the archery, muzzleloader, and rifle hunts. And we felt like that would, obviously be a detriment to the people that had been waiting for 14, 15 years to have that many more people hunting. And so we went with this, management hunt, and it's worked great. So anyway, my two cents is it's been a good thing, and, we support the recommendations that the Fish and Game would give this year.
Thank you. Yeah, and we'll turn comments over to the right. Sam?
Yeah, Wade and Jeremy. Who is over that landowner committee now? I've been sending the packets to Bob Ott and Mickey Houston and that bunch. Now, I just want to make sure that they're getting a copy of what we're doing over here.
I'm almost a member of the association, so I'll comment for him. Bob is the president. There are four board members and a secretary. They have a one board meeting once a year. They haven't had a general membership meeting in 5, 6, 7 years.
Okay, I just hadn't heard from them. I just wanted to make sure I was getting...
No one has heard from them.
Okay.
Do we have any other comments from the right? Do we need a clarification on what we do with the split recommendation?
But you can deal with the splits one by one if you want, or the division recommendation is there, the ones that, you know, what our recommendation is versus the landowner association. So if there's particular ones you want to deal with, you can individually, or you can do it in one fell swoop.
Just make a motion to accept it all in one swoop. Okay. If we have no further comments, we're ready to entertain a motion.
I make a motion that we accept the proposal on the Landowner Association as presented.
Do we have a second? Okay, we have a second from Cordell. Is there any discussion on the motion? Okay, we're ready to vote. All those in favor? Unanimous. Thank you. Okay, we'll move on to the next action item, which is the Utah Hunter Mentoring Program, and that'll be presented by Greg Hansen.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the RAC. My name is Greg Hansen, and I'm here to present a new licensing program proposed by the Division of Wildlife, the Utah Hunter Mentoring Program. Last year, the Utah legislature passed amendments to the Wildlife Code that allowed for certain situations when a child could share a hunting permit held by an adult, with that adult serving as a mentor and taking the child out into the field, teaching them proper hunting ethics and safety, and trying to recruit them into the sport of hunting. The main goal of the program was to increase youth participation in hunting, provide that structure that is necessary to bring kids into the sport, and to encourage hunting as a family experience. So the division took the changes to Utah Code and drafted a new administrative rule The program allows both a minor or has stipulations that both minor children and the mentoring adults meet certain qualifications that are laid out both in code and in the new rule. It sets up an administrative process to ensure that those who are participating in the program actually qualify, and enables the division to track who's using these permits and how successful the program's being. And then also lays out a framework for what the minor and the mentor do in the field to ensure that the purpose for the program is actually being fulfilled, that these kids are actually being trained in a way that that's expected. So the question, can my child participate in the program? The program's open to only Utah resident children. The child has to be between the ages of 12 and 17 when they're hunting. And they must possess a Utah Hunter's Education number, so they have to actually go through a Hunter's Education program. There are two different classifications of kids that qualify. First is if the child is the child, stepchild, grandchild, or legal ward of the mentor that is taking them out in the field, or if the child is suffering from a life-threatening medical condition. Those children do not have to be related to the hunting mentor in order to participate in the program. In order to be a hunting mentor, you can be either a resident or a non-resident. You must possess a valid big game permit. You must be 21 years or older when taking the child out into the field, and you must comply with all items listed in the Wildlife Code, the administrative rules, and provided in the big game proclamation. A further element is that mentors are not allowed to be compensated for taking a child out into the field. This program is supposed to be encouraging family experiences, not providing a mechanism where individuals are paid to take kids out in the field. So if you believe that you qualify for the program, the rule requires that you submit an application to the division at least 10 days before the date that you actually want to use the permit. A handling fee will be assessed in order to do the paperwork associated with participating in the program. And the hunting mentor has to provide all evidence related to qualifying for the program. So the permit number that will be shared, right now we've opened it up to all big game permits. A description of the minor that will be going out in the field, the minor's hunter education number, and a certification that the minor actually qualifies, that they are the child, grandchild, legal ward, or stepchild of the mentor, or that they have a life-threatening medical condition. Further, if the child that will be going out in the field is not if the mentor that's taking the child out into the field is not the legal guardian of the child, we're also asking that they provide written authorization from the minor's parents to ensure that the minor's parents are aware of what's going on. Right now we've limited the program to only one minor mentor pair per permit that's shared, but we've set up a process where if the mentor wants to share the permit with another child, they can surrender the child's sharing with child number one, submit a new application, and share it with the child number two. But to start out with, we're limiting it to one minor mentor pair per permit at a time. If you do qualify, there are stipulations for when you're in the field. First, the mentor must be close enough to the minor to communicate with voice and hand signals. That's actually laid out in the code section. The mentor must provide advice and assistance with technique, safety, and proper hunting ethics. And the mentor is responsible for carrying all items that relate to complying with the code section and rule. So they have to possess the permit, the hunting license, all of the certifications that were provided to qualify for the program, and the division's approval that they qualified and can share the permit. You'll notice the asterisk by the license word there. We've waived the license requirement for the child in order to encourage participation with the program. So the mentor and the minor may carry a firearm in the field, but only one animal may be taken and tagged per permit. So we're sticking close to that one permit, one animal taken restriction. And then if you do take an animal, or you do qualify and participate in the program, the rules for variances, surrenders, refunds, and disability accommodations will all be based on the type of permit and the individual using the permit. And all bonus points, preference points, and waiting periods will be assessed to the mentor, so the original person that drew the big game permit, not the child. And with that, I thank you for your time.
Keep forgetting to turn this on. Thank you very much. Do we have any questions from the RAC? Do we have any questions from the public?
I guess I got two questions. Do all the draw permits in the state, are they involved in this? Like the once-in-a-lifetime tags?
They are. It's open to all big game permits, once-in-a-lifetime included.
What has anybody ever thought of what that would do, the drawing odds on these, if all the parents and grandparents and whatever that aren't putting in now put in, so they take a kid hunting? I mean, that's got to be huge, I'd think.
Yes, that was a consideration. One item was that the individual that draws the permit has to actually go into the field and act as a mentor. And so there is that one element that will limit the number of people that actually participate in the program. Second, recruiting youth into the sport seemed like a big enough incentive that that was just a consideration that we took into account. But that is definitely something that's been discussed, and we'd be willing to take your guys' advice on that as well.
I want to ask a serious question in a dumb way, if that's all right. Braden Richmond, was there any discussion with this? I think we're not naive enough in here to know that this isn't already going on. Is there a discussion that we're helping good people be honest, and that was part of the incentive with this?
I don't believe that question was ever framed to me in that way. I think this is an activity that we want to facilitate, and I think we are aware that this is going on. A lot of other states participate or have a program similar to this, and they see high rates of participation, and possibly setting up a structure where we are legalizing something that right now is illegal but is happening pretty often, and maybe that was a consideration, but the main purpose is to recruit youth into the sport.
I was just wondering if
please state your name again for the record. Thank you.
Gene Boardman.
Thanks, Gene.
I was just wondering if say on the general deer season or the general elk season, if the youth draws a tag and takes an animal on that tag, can he also participate in this mentoring thing and take another animal?
I believe there are other sections in the wildlife code that limit your taking of an animal to one big game animal per year. And so an individual would have to still comply with all of those restrictions in the wildlife code, one animal per person.
One male animal, one male. Buck, one
yes.
Bull, one...
Yes.
Yeah.
We have any other questions? Okay. We'll turn it over to comments from the public. Again, I have a comment from the Executive Board of the Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. They are in support of this action. And then I have a comment card from Lee Tracy.
We've opened up a can of worms, folks. Concerning the draw odds, particularly with once-in-a-lifetime, Personally, I have 13 moose points. But if this plan goes into effect, there'll be a lot of my competitors, of course, will perhaps drop out from that high point, you know, the higher point groups and stuff. But the problem we'll have will come down in the years to come, because not only can Grandpa and Grandma and on both sides, that's four, and Mom and Dad, that's six, and then any of their friends who get permission from Mom and Dad will be able to apply for those tags. Has it been? I'm not sure why the once in a lifetime and the limited entry hunts are included in this. The United Wildlife Cooperative would not oppose the general tags, deer and elk tags, were included in this. But I think we've opened a can of worms, and if the United Wildlife Cooperative would support this if it were limited to the general hunts of elk and deer. Thank you.
I also have a comment card from Braden Richmond.
Braden Richmond, representing myself. I was hoping to stay in my seat on this because I thought this would fly through and I couldn't imagine any opposition. Frankly, I'm a little disappointed that a conservation group that touts themselves as wanting opportunity would stand and not like this. This is a great program. Our youth, our preference point and the point creep is all but eliminating our youth's opportunity from limited hunts. And it's greed, and we want to keep those for ourselves, and we are eliminating the opportunity for kids. We all know how difficult it is to draw these tags. This is a great program. Let's not even go down that road. Thank you.
DeLoss.
I'm the same way with some of the comments that have been made. I didn't expect I would have to comment on this, but I think maybe I should. I think human nature is such that if there's something that you don't expect will happen or that can happen, it will. And while I got lots of grandkids, and they love to hunt, and I got lots of points, and I'm getting pretty old, and I'm really getting fat. And I'd like to be able to give it to one of those youngsters someday. But here's a concern I've got, and I don't know how you could ever police it. Let's suppose that I get a real need for some money. And one of my rich friends says, I got a son that I'd like to take hunting. Could I buy that opportunity from you? And that's a concern I'd have. And I don't know how you close the door on that. I just don't know how you do it without, I mean, you could do that so quietly nobody'd ever know.
DeLoss, let me, the rule does not allow that.
I know it doesn't allow it.
So that could happen right now, irregardless of this.
How so? How so could it happen?
But it's not legal under this. It's not legal now, so it's illegal either way.
Well, I realize that, but right now there's no advantage. I mean, I guess if I take him out and I hand him my gun, is that what you're saying? Well, that's a little different. Okay. Well, I'm just telling you my opinion. Yep. I understand.
Never mind.
I didn't take my minutes. Let me explain that I only used myself as an example. The fact of the matter is, I'm the last member of my family that hunts. Okay? So this would be great for somebody else, but it, you know. And there are, and I'm not speaking just for myself, I'm speaking for all the others who have, who waited, you know, 15, 20 years for, to draw a tag. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't do it, I'm just saying we need to limit it, to the general tags. After all, you take a 12-year-old kid up to shoot a bighorn sheep, what's he gonna shoot next?
Okay, that's all the comment cards I have. Do we have comments from the right? Okay. Paul? Or Dale? Excuse me.
I just have one concern on it. If you're sharing the tag, I would think you ought to share the gun, so to speak. I don't know that you should have two guns out there. Let the youth pack the gun and you mentor him, but I don't know that there's a need for two guns out there with one tag.
I've actually talked to a couple people about this, and I think it's better to, if a 12-year-old or up to a 17-year-old gut shoots a deer, it is far better to have a mentor put it down and recover that deer than have that 12-year-old go through that experience if you can avoid it. I see that being an advantage of having the two guns in the field. It's pretty tough to rip a 12-year-old's gun out of his hands.
Do we have any additional comments? Okay, before we entertain a motion, I just want to review again some comments from the audience, and one of the main comments was to limit this program to the general season deer and elk, or to that we had, and then we did have support, a lot of support for the program as presented.
I would like to make a motion that we pass it as is.
Okay, we have a motion from Brian. We have a second from Dale. Do we have discussion on the motion? Okay, all those in favor? Is it unanimous? Thank you. Okay, we'll move on to item number 9, which is the dedicated hunter rule amendments. And that will be presented to us by Brian Christensen. Oh, excuse me. We have one item that we need to discuss first.
Yeah, we had one comment card come up, and I'm not sure it didn't really fit anywhere in tonight's agenda, but I wanted to make sure that we didn't have somebody travel here and not, if they had questions, get it addressed. Gary May, are you in the audience? So your comment card about opposing the premium limited entry deer or putting unit 20, that's not something that we're proposing right now. Okay. It's not something that's being proposed now, so I think we're in good shape. It may be in the future, and we'll try to make sure you're aware if it ever does. So. Okay. Could I have you give that to Jason back there? He's the biologist over that unit, and is probably the best way, because it's not part of this agenda. Let me have you just deal with Jason one-on-one on this right now, and if it becomes an issue later, we can deal with it then.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, or the RAC could, if they want to address it, could put it on the action log in the future. But I didn't want somebody to travel all the way here and then not get what they came for addressed. So I think we can move on now.
Okay, we're ready for the presentation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman and RAC members.
My name is Brian Christensen. I'm the dedicated hunter and volunteer service coordinator in Salt Lake. Today, this rule, R657-38, that governs the dedicated hunter program, is up for some changes, some recommendations that we have. The last time it was changed was in 2011 when we were preparing for the unit hunting structure away from the regional hunting structure. And it's not uncommon after, you know, 2-3 years to have a rule running and identify some things that could be realigned or adjusted, you know, some things that could be done better. So I'll kind of go into some of that. But essentially what we're going to try to do today with this rule revision is reorganize the rule, simplify it dramatically. That's always something we're requested to do. Clarify it. We've got a few updates, and then as we were combing through all those different things, it gave us an opportunity to address a Wildlife Board action log item that they gave us. So as far as simplification, the items I've got listed here, basically we're going to remove all the wording that was unique to that transition from regional hunting to unit hunting. It was very specific to 2012 and just doesn't apply anymore. We removed the dates from when the division is required to print and mail permits. We've left that a little bit more open-ended for us. Another thing we've done with this to simplify is that there are dedicated hunters at the end of their 3 years that sometimes end up owing some hours. And what that means is they maybe didn't get all their permits. They got one or two, but never the third, and still had hours to finish up when their third-year term expired. Currently, they're required to pay off those hours. And this rule change allows them to either pay off the hours or complete those hours through project service. And the last one is to broaden the time frame in which permits can be returned. Every dedicated hunter that does not harvest is required to return that tag to prove that they did not take a deer that year. Each year there's a time set in the rule. It's been January in the past. Last year it was March 15th. We're just removing that date. We can administer that process without having a hard date in rule. Clarifications and updates. The COR currently expires the last day of the year. We'd like to change that so it expires on the last day of the general season. That way it expires whenever the last day of the hunt is, and that may mean the extended archery hunt. When there's an extended archery hunt, it may mean the end of the season when there's not a hunt. So it's just whatever the last day of the possible hunt could be. The definition of youth will update that to the same definition that Justin presented earlier tonight. The dedicated hunter preference point, this little clause we've added in there indicates which dedicated hunters certificates of registration that get surrendered become eligible for reinstatement of preference points. It's very similar to what we do with general season deer tags right now. Second to last here, poaching reported reward permits. We've added one clarification in the case that a dedicated hunter is also a recipient of a poaching reported reward permit, and it tells us what that dedicated hunter can do because they can't have two deer in the same year. And then the last here is a definition that we've needed to put in place, and we're going to actually insert this program orientation course definition into R657-62, which is the application rule. It's just a definition for what the program orientation is that they would take before applying. We feel it fits very well within the application rule rather than not having any definition at all. So, moving on to the action log item, I want to read this word for word what we had, and it was for the DWR to reconsider allowing dedicated hunter program applicants to accrue volunteer hours in the first year after they apply in the program rather than waiting until the final selections and approval. So right now, dedicated hunters will find out if they've drawn into the program roughly May 31st. And then they have those next 10 weeks before the archery hunts to start. That's a pretty short time frame to get, you know, their 8 hours done. And so this action log asks us to look and see what could happen, ways to get those hours accomplished in that short a time or open up that time frame. So we did. We went through a variety of scenarios. We were able to come up with some different programs that would work fine, at least on paper. They would be okay. To give you a little more in depth here, the service hours I mentioned, they've got that 10 weeks or so. Some dedicated hunters have also expressed, you know, the option to maybe do hours beforehand before they join the program. In 2013, we had about 19,000 hours that we needed to provide in that time frame. So it's kind of a short time to do a lot. But fortunately, we have some excellent staff, the dedicated hunter program coordinators throughout the state, and our conservation partners, our federal agency partners, and the division. We've been able to provide those needs. So as we explored these different banking type concepts where you'd get hours beforehand before joining, we came up with these different versions but found that none of them really was in the best interest of both the division and the dedicated hunter. There seemed to be some that would work for us as a division and some that would work more for a dedicated hunter, but none of them really worked the best for everybody. And so we took a different angle at it. And what we came up with was a different scenario altogether, in which we could, instead of banking hours earlier and trying to do hours before somebody joins a program, we could redistribute the hours while they're in it. So what we're recommending is that in year one, the dedicated hunter will do their conservation ethics course, the training course that they do, but not be required to do any service hours that year to obtain their first permit. The second year, they'll be required to complete 16 hours. The third year, an additional 16. So the hour requirement stays at 32. But what we do here in this scenario is we give them essentially a year and a half to have those first 16 hours done, rather than trying to make all of them do 8 hours each in 10 weeks before the hunt start. So we feel very confident that this is a good thing for both the dedicated hunter and for the division. We feel like it's going to bolster the springtime projects that are a pretty big deal, especially here in the southern region, as spring comes here quicker than it does other places. And it kind of reduces that last-minute stress of providing 19,000 hours in that short time frame. So we feel that this is a pretty good way to handle the request from the Wildlife Board and is in favor of the public and the division. So thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the RAC? Go ahead.
When you have the breakdown on the hours and the years that they have to be done, that doesn't mean to say that a dedicated hunter gets in the program the first year and completes 16 hours. He can do that. That's pretty optional of what hours he can complete during what year.
That's exactly
right. As
long
as he gets the 32 at the end.
Yeah, and many dedicated hunters prefer to do all their hours in their first year. So they can do as many as they want that first year. They just won't be required to have that amount to obtain the first tag.
So tell me again why you don't like the banking side of it the first year.
Okay. That's an excellent question. There's two main types of programs where we could do banking. The first one, maybe I can back this up just a little bit. I started this position in December, and since then, that's all I've been able to think about is how do we make this work? Because I really like it. I like the banking concept. And then as we explored it, we came up with two ideas. One was to do a one-year bank. So essentially, you would do your hours before you joined up, anticipate joining, and if you joined, we would apply those hours to your COR. If you didn't, those hours would be considered volunteer hours, and they'd basically just go away. We've discussed it with some different groups and some dedicated hunters, and for the most part, everybody seemed to be agreeable about that. It does have a drawback, though, and if you can imagine yourself maybe doing 8 or 10, 16 hours, and then not drawing, it's not the best feeling. Even though you may feel like that's what you should do anyway as a sportsman, it still isn't the most favorable option to not have those hours count. And so the second question comes, well, why not let it count for the next year? Because by then you might be able to draw. And it opens up a bigger field of indefinite banking. So you could bank hours this year, next year, the year after, and then eventually draw in. Or maybe you're banking for 10 years. And then I have a list here, and I don't know how in-depth you want me to go, but I've got about 8 or 10 things that start to become problematic when you open up a program like that. It changes the philosophy of the program, where we really want people to join and do their service concurrent with kind of enjoying the reward of hunting three seasons. It can be problematic as far as programming and things like that. It also starts to beg, questions of how early can you start banking hours? Can you start when you're 8 years old, even before you're allowed to hunt? Does it start when you're 12? Can you buy those hours in advance? So there's a whole lot of different things that create complications, and some of them are good, and some of them aren't favorable to either division or the hunter. So does that answer your question sufficiently, or too much, or not enough? Or?
A little bit. So where are we going from? What's it been in the past? What was it?
So what was it in the past?
The hours, yeah.
Okay. 8 hours the first year. Okay. To get your first tag and the conservation course. 16 additional the second year, and then 8 the third year. So what this essentially does is they have a lot of time to do their first 16 hours, and then an extra year. The following year they can do another 16, or like was pointed out earlier, they could do 8 the first year, or 10, 12, whatever they want. They're not limited.
Some of the problems, I'm on some groups that do a lot of springtime thing, free fishing days, banquets, those kind of things, and we're missing a third of our dedicated hunters to help volunteer for those hours because they don't know if they're going to be a dedicated hunter until May.
Right.
So, and a lot of those programs are in the springtime. The proposal was just, make it simple. One banking, one year. That first year they can bank the hours. Mm-hmm. They understand that they lose them if they don't draw. So there's no, it's just like not drawing a tag.
Yeah.
But it seems to me your 16 hours, it'll probably help it some.
I have a question, but I'm going to save my comments for the comment section.
Okay. If I can address just part of that.
Okay.
With the 16 hours, if this recommendation goes through, we would have basically a one-year time frame in which it would take people to start jumping into those spring projects. So this year, 2014, we may or may not see a dramatic change as far as spring projects, but 2015, it would open up all of those people from 2014 to get in on springtime projects. Whereas before it wouldn't do that. So it's 1 year behind, but it would open a lot of people up to do spring projects that otherwise wouldn't. They would wait until they knew if they could do it or not.
I have a question. And the question, I already know the answer to. You've addressed it well, but I wanted to get it in the minutes. It seemed like this is something I've been watching for over a year. I've sent in letters addressing this. It's dear and near to me. I love the dedicated hunter program. It does a lot of good things. But there was a lot of confusion even today among wildlife board members, among leaders of sportsmen's groups that have prepared an opinion. And many of those felt like they were coming today supporting a banking type proposal from the DWR. So, again, you've clarified it, but does this proposal include any banking hours for somebody that's applying their first year to do work prior to them receiving their notification?
Okay. Specifically, no. This recommendation does not have a provision for banking hours prior to joining the Dedicated Hunter program.
Okay. Do we have any other questions from the RAC?
The area where you said that they, on their third year, they owe you hours? How do they get their third permit and still owe hours?
Okay, that's a good question. They don't. They don't have their third permit. Sometimes they don't have any of their permits. They've joined the program and didn't do any hours. And
so it prevents them from entering again mm-hmm. the program until they...
Yeah, so if a dedicated hunter finishes the program but still owes hours, they go on what's called an administrative hold that prevents them from doing any applications for permits until those are cleared up. What we're really just hoping to do is give them an option to jump on a project, which we'd rather have service hours in lieu of just paying them off.
Go ahead, Sam.
How many of these hours can they buy?
Residents can purchase 24 of the 32. Non-residents may purchase all of the 32.
Okay. Do we have any further questions from the RAC? Do we have any questions from the audience? Okay, we'll take comments. I do have a comment card, just one from Paul Niemeyer.
Again, Paul Niemeyer. I keep the records for two of these conservation banquet committees. And I've talked to pretty much all of them. And they would rather be able to bank hours starting January 1st. And if they don't draw, then they're okay about that. Well, they just donate the hours. But they do want to start January 1st and some of these banquets and different things they can count. And I think it's underprescribed anyway, isn't it? Isn't there more people right there now? There are less people drawing than there is, more people drawing than there is putting in. So it's undersubscribed anyway, but let these people, you know, Rusty was kind of alluding to that. I think he's probably been around these banquets and stuff too, but let them bank those hours. Cause I mean, these guys are the kind of guys that are donating a ton of time anyway, but let them bank them from January. And if they don't draw, then they just give them up. That's our recommendation.
Thank you. I also have a comment card from Gene Boardman.
I've been showing up every year. I'm Gene Boardman. I've been showing up every year since this dedicated Hunter program started to rile against it, and I'm still against it, and I'd sure as heck like to see it go away. I've never killed a deer that was there because of the dedicated hunter program. I don't know that I've ever seen a deer that was there because of the dedicated hunter program, but I've sure as hell gave up a lot of tags to the dedicated hunter program. And this buying point. Now, if that isn't being able to purchase opportunity that the rest of us don't have, what in the hell is it? I think that this, you can get your dedicated hours without this dedicated hunter program. I think people will come out and do it. I think it's time to look for another way. But this idea that people can pay money and get to hunt three hunts while the rest of us can only hunt one is not what hunting in Utah it ought to be all about. Thanks.
Thank you, Gene. Bryce, do you want me to read your card, or did you have a comment on this? Okay, thank you. With no further comment cards from the audience, we'll see if there's comments from the rack. I'd like to make a comment, if I could. I personally have been a strong supporter of the Dedicated Hunter program. I am a dedicated hunter. My wife is a dedicated hunter. But we also work with some groups in St. George where we do a kids fishing derby, fishing day. We have anywhere from 600 to 800 kids come on a Saturday. That activity could not happen without the support of dedicated hunters. 3 years ago, we started an additional day of fishing with handicapped kids. We've had to keep that very small, allowing only three or four schools to come because it's hard to get dedicated hunters to come, or anybody to come on a work day when the kids are in school. We need dedicated hunters to make that happen. We are currently planning on a plan where we can have all the special needs kids in Washington County come on one day and fish. We cannot do that without dedicated hunters. That will not be successful without it. We need dedicated hunters. The group that I work with is in strong support of having some type of banking system because our programs are in April before they know. And I've, since this came out, there's a third of the pool of people that I call and ask to come and help that don't come because they're waiting to draw and they can't bank their hours. And I think that, especially right now, where everybody that puts in essentially is going to draw out and they know that they're going to draw, let them come and work and support us that we need. I don't think that the plan right now addresses all the concerns. It does address some concerns that were brought up, but it doesn't address the groups that need the hunters. Now, also mentioned are the sportsmen's groups. Their banquets are in February and March. They need dedicated hunters for their programs to work as well. And if they're losing a third of the people to come, they're going to suffer as well. And that's my comment on it is that, you know, we had an action item, and what came back doesn't necessarily meet the goal that we was hoping to get from that action log item. Is there any other comments? Okay, we're ready to entertain a motion on this item. Rusty?
Yes, I'd like to make a motion to accept the division's recommendations with the exception of the banking hours. I'd like to see that they were able to bank hours from January 1 to the May 30th when the applications are drawn or recognized.
Do we have a second on that motion? Okay, we have a second from Sam. Do you have any discussion on that motion? All those in favor? Unanimous? Okay, our last item is item number 10, which is the Oak Creek Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep Management Plan, and that's by Dustin Shiloh.
My name is Dustin Shiley. I'm here to present the Oak Creek Management Plan for Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep. To give you some background, the Oak Creek is currently unoccupied, but historic bighorn sheep habitat. Like with many other areas in Utah, they were extirpated during settlement periods. The area has been approved by the Wildlife Board through this bighorn sheep statewide management plan, and now we're just proposing the unit management plan. There's renewed interest in restoring bighorn sheep to this area because of the 2012 Clay Springs fire. It was a large-scale fire, burned over 100,000 acres, kind of restoring valuable sheep habitat. And we're in a great spot to reestablish them to this range. And so this proposal is just to reestablish them. Similar to the statewide plan, we went through several issues and concerns, including disease, predation, poaching, competition, impacts to private lands, coordination with land management agencies, and we identified all those issues and concerns specific to the Oak Creek, and they're all included in the plan. So the population objective and strategies portion for the plan will be to what we want to do is manage for up to 300 sheep, Rocky Mountain Bighorn sheep, across the unit. This number may be less if disease issues become a concern. But in order to do this, we'll begin with transplants, initially of 40 to 60 sheep. They're likely going to be in-state sources like the Antelope Island or the Newfoundland Mountains. And then the habitat portion of the plan, since we've got brand new or the habitat that's in an early successional state, we want to keep that way and continue to maintain it and make sure it's productive for sheep, and then identify specific projects to benefit sheep specifically and then work with the land management agencies to get those on the ground. And then finally, the recreation objective would be to manage the population to a viable level, allow the biologist to determine that it's stable enough to sustain harvest, and then we'd make hunt recommendations consistent with the statewide management plan. And then we'd also look for opportunities to promote non-consumptive uses.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions from the RAC? Okay, Mike?
On this unit, I see that there's about 40% private land. If it ever does reach huntable populations, will private landowners get 40% of the tax? Is that how that works? I don't know on the statewide.
Where the sheep habitat is on is actually, it's all 100%, as I understand, is on the Forest Service. So where we expect sheep to be occupying. If they do get onto the private lands, we have like depredation policy to handle that. We also have a policy and guideline if sheep get into domestic sheep, how to handle that. And that's how we'd address that. But in terms of permits, unless it was a depredation situation, there's no program for that.
Yeah, the Landowner Association program doesn't apply to once-in-a-lifetime species.
Any other questions? Do we have any questions in the audience? I have no comment cards. Is there one? Oh, okay. Oh, excuse me. You're right. And the executive board of the Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife support this action plan. Do we have any comments from the RAC? Sean?
Yeah, Dustin made the comment that, which is true, that pretty much the predominant amount of habitats can be unforested. And we were asked to give a position letter. The man was supposed to read it, didn't show up, but I guess I better read it just so we get it on the record. It's addressed to Dave Black, Southern Region RAC Chair. So, dear Mr. Black, this letter is in reference to the Oak Creek Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep Management Plan that has been proposed to set the framework for establishing bighorn sheep in southern Utah. The Forest Service appreciates the opportunity to provide comments on this plan proposed introduction of bighorn sheep into southern Utah. The Forest Service made the following observations regarding this proposed plan. We acknowledge that
If the proposed introduction is implemented, it would occur on approximately 8% of the lands administered by the Fish Lake National Forest, Fillmore Ranger District. That 8% is what forest lands are in the entire unit. Clarifications that what he's saying is that it will happen on the forest. The Fish Lake National Forest has reviewed the land resource management plan and finds that the proposed introduction of bighorn sheep is consistent with language contained within the plan, which speaks of allowing for establishment of desirable species on sites that can supply the habitat needs of the species. The Forest Service has determined that there are currently no sheep grazing on lands administered by the Forest Service in the Canyon Range portion of the Fillmore Ranger District. There's adequate habitat for bighorn sheep along with cattle, deer, and elk currently grazing in the area. Based on the information above, I concluded that that approval of the Oak Creek Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep Management Plan by the Wildlife Board and introduction of bighorn sheep in the Canyon Range is not in conflict with the Fish Lake Land and Resource Management Plan, and the Forest Service supports this proposal. In closing, we appreciate the opportunity to provide comments to this proposed plan and look forward to working cooperatively with the state in implementation phase of this project. We look forward to working with the division in the future on any needed changes to the management plan based on natural resource condition monitoring. And if you have questions, it gives you the contact, and it's signed Alan Rowley, Forest Supervisor.
Thank you, Sean. Is there any other comments from the right? Okay. Claire?
I think it's a fantastic idea. I'd love to see new introductions like this in an appropriate habitat, especially for a species like the bighorn sheep that's been such an important part of the history of Utah, going back to the ancient inhabitants of this land. It was probably their primary prey. And as such, I would propose that we accept the division's recommendation on this.
Okay, we have a motion and a second by Rusty. Is there any discussion on the motion? All those in favor? Unanimous? Thank you. That concludes item number 10. We do have one item of business, and turn time over to Kevin.
Just in reference to our next meeting on December 10th, I know it says on our agenda here that it's the Falconry Guidebook and Rule. There's actually several items that will be coming to us that night, and I've just mentioned it now so that to make sure that there's support and we have at least a quorum here. There'll be several licensing, some changes to our licensing rule. We'll be dealing with our error and our variance rule, which is how we deal with you know, people when there's been a mistake made by the division. And then also Scott will be back talking about some changes to the landowner association rules. So there will be plenty of items for us to deliberate over on that December meeting. So don't plan to go Christmas shop and plan to be in Beaver that night.
Excuse me? You're just kidding. Rusty, did you have a comment?
I do have a comment. I have a question on the application of the license. It's currently legitimate to apply for tags with one big one. We can't close that loophole. People are buying a license at the end of the month of, say, 2012 in January, whenever the application period is, and then they can use that same license. It's just a current license and apply for 2013 permits. Can we fix that? Is that doable, Kevin? Why do we allow that to happen?
Well, we made the change. It was only 6 or 7 years ago now that we required them to have a license at all. And I don't know how you do it, Rusty, where you have, essentially a 2-month application period and a 365-day license. You know, I guess I don't know how you would with the way it's currently set up.
Well, just change the wording that to apply for 2014, you have to have a current 2014 license.
Well, but if they bought their license in in November or in March of 2013, that is a valid license in still in February of 2014.
You catch them the next year anyway.
Right.
Not if they don't draw. The out-of-state guys are doing it. I've got three buddies that are doing it.
Yeah, it does. It does allow people to. It does allow you to apply twice on a single license. But you know what, Rusty? The benefit that we've gotten by adding that in is worth letting people get, you know, double bang for it, to be honest with you. It's been a great thing for revenue generation and everything else as it is. So you would, but why be greedy? I understand what you're saying.
Make a motion to adjourn.
We're adjourned.